HD1 Detroit. Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the RIF at 4WRIF. That's 49743. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Oh, thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter. It's our final broadcast for 2013.
And we are not going to have a roundup.
No, you know, we're not going to do the recap of the year. It's so funny. We've never really talked about that before, but I cannot stand recaps. I don't like them. I don't want to I want to move forward. I don't want to relive everything.
I would like it if we recorded little snippets from our callers, some of the greatest.
because we've had some doozies, yes, haven't we?
Hey, folks, this...
And some really great callers. We appreciate you. We should say that.
Absolutely.
We don't say it often enough.
And all the people that make the program happen.
Yes, Jefferson answering the phones in the other room. Thank you, Jefferson, for being dedicated and coming in here every Sunday night. We appreciate it.
Jeremy Campbell, who puts this up as a podcast, although we missed last week. He must be on vacation.
Yeah, well, he's been in and out. Everyone's in and out of the studio right now. It's just kind of a weird time for radio. Peter, what are you frantically searching for?
My cheat sheet so I can, like, remember the phone number.
Okay, 248-544-WRIF. 248-544-9743. You can get us at facebook.com/nightcall, and you can email us at calltechyes@yahoo.com, or you can check out Peter's website at peterwerby, W-E-R-B-E.com. See, you should just have me do it every week. You don't need a cheat sheet. You have me.
There you go, and you'd never know. That Jalene is, should I say this, really tired.
Oh, yeah.
Talk us about that.
Oh, well. Well, you know, tis the season, and I work a lot during the holidays. I've worked every day. I've been on the air for eight, nine days in a row. I'm only going to do 1 hour of the show tonight. I hate to say that. I have to get up early in the morning, so it's all you, Peter. Oh, how did you do it for 30 years without me? You're going to find out.
I don't know, yeah. Hey, but can you imagine that we are going to talk about socialism?
The Duck Dynasty. Oh, okay.
Pussy Riot,
yes,
the band.
Which is the name of a band.
And seven ripoffs that capitalists would like to keep out of the media.
Okay. Sounds like a juicy little lineup there.
Well, actually, and this makes sense, also an epidemic of attention deficit disorder, which is perfectly.
Do you believe that?
Yeah. Let's see. Where I am losing everything. Oh, no, here it is. Yeah. I don't know if people are watching TV tonight, but they had the awards presented to what they call the Kennedy Senator Awards
honors,
in New York City.
The honors. Center, yeah. Honors.
And as usual, President and Mrs. Obama were there. And one of the awardees was Santana, richly deserved, of course.
Oh, so glad. Yay!
And so they were playing Santana songs, different artists. And Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine was playing the guitar. And he had something written on the guitar. And everybody else's guitar they showed. Now Morello is a big-time lefty.
He's one of us.
Yes.
For sure. I've met him before. He is such a cool guy. When I was out on tour with one of our friends, with David Rovick, mm-hmm. one time, and it was the last big protest in Chicago last spring.
Yeah.
NAFTA.
NATO.
NATO.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a protest against NATO. Well deserved.
Oh, yeah.
That used to be the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that's now trying to line people up in Eastern Europe, countries up in Eastern Europe.
It was the G8, too, but they moved them all, remember?
Yeah, that's right.
At the last minute because of all of us rabble-rousers.
Now, there's a long tradition of writing on one's guitar, and Woody Guthrie, the way back 30s and 40s folky that influenced Bob Dylan so much, right up into the 1930s, or through the 1930s and 1940s, on his guitar, it was written on his guitar, "This machine kills fascists."
Wow. Yeah. Just through the word.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Music.
So President Obama is celebrating Christmas out in Hawaii. He sang carols, opened presents with his family, and then visited a nearby military base and wishing the troops Merry Christmas. But one thing, this article says, the president and his family did not do something they have rarely done since he entered the White House, was attend Christmas church services. Did you know?
No, I did know that. And, well, I was just thinking... First of all, I don't care.
Yeah.
Second of all, is there any attempt by him in this whole separation of church and state, not putting God so much into politics?
Well, he still sponsors this National Day of Prayer, which is clearly unconstitutional.
Well, if he...
What about separation of church and state?
Yeah, if he said no to that National Day of Prayer, can you imagine the backlash?
Yeah. Well, Gary Scott Smith, who wrote a book called Faith in the Presidency, from George Washington to George W. Bush, said Obama has not gone to church hardly at all as president, adding that it is very unusual for a president not to attend Christmas services. And his religious habits appear to be in step with a changing America, with fewer people these days reporting that they attend church on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve. According to the Pew Research Center released this month, 54% of adults said they plan to attend Christmas religious services, while 69% said they traditionally did so as children. Now,
all the way growing up.
The big word, I never did. The big word here is plan to attend, 54%. Now, we've talked about this before. Yeah, the two things, if you're a longtime listener, you've heard this little rap before. But in polls, the two things that people lie about is sex and religion, right?
Okay.
So do you go to church every Sunday? Oh, yeah, certainly. And more than that, oh, yeah, sometimes, Tuesdays and Thursdays. And how many times a week do you have sex? Nine,
three times a day.
Yeah, what do you do? Well, I have sex and go to church. Do you work? Oh, yeah, I go to work sometimes. So, I mean, it's ridiculous. And so there were...
People lie about their weight, too.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. Sociologists went into this little town and asked how many people in this little town went to church services regularly.
Okay.
And some enormous amount did. Then they counted up the number of pews available in that particular town in all the churches. A lot of these little towns have lots of churches. Mm-hmm. And in no way could have accommodated everybody,
yeah.
Right, that said I go to church every single Sunday.
Why do people feel the need to do that?
To
lie about it. I mean, it's not doing any good to lie about it. And isn't kind of against the way religion works?
I don't mean to sound really dumb, but here I will. I'm willing to do it publicly. Is that one of the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt not lie? Is that in
it? I don't know. I just know that the one that sticks with me is don't do it with your neighbor's wife.
No, you're not even supposed to covet her.
Well, I'm doomed because I'm practically married to my next door neighbor.
Well, I'm doomed. Most guys are doomed too, you know, just for coveting, you know, like checking it out.
Y'all can covet away. I don't care.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy Carter, don't you remember? He said he sinned in his heart, the president.
No.
Because he had coveted other men's wife. I mean, God. Well, I shouldn't say that. You can't even fantasize? Come on.
Is that what coveting is strictly fantasizing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm not coveting.
I never understood a lot of the Ten Commandments anyway. Well, we should play George Carlin's Ten Commandments. You know why there's Ten Commandments? It's a marketing device. Ten most wanted, ten best dressed. Right?
Yes. Should miss him.
I never understood a lot of these. And, I mean, people made them up, right?
Yes.
Although, I mean, well, they're supposed to be, well, and also there was the, who was that guy? Was it a 2,000-year-old man? Moses came down from the mountain with two big tablets, and he says, I have here the 20 commandments.
And
he says, I have here the 10 commandments, and if I'm offending anybody, I don't care.
It just brings back, brings images of Charlton Heston in my head.
You know why I don't care?
Don't do that to me.
I don't want to offend anybody, and some people hold religious beliefs very strongly. But if there is a God, and he is the master and the creator of the universe, why would he care if you took his name in vain? I mean, some little twerp, you know, with a microphone is saying, nah, like me.
It's a word. I mean,
what, twerp?
No, taking his name in vain.
Why would he care?
It's just a word.
Why would he care?
I don't know.
And why would he want to be worshipped? He couldn't be insecure.
Well,
I mean, could you create the universe? I have to be worshipped.
There's a lot of people with big egos out there, but I don't know.
Oh, let's get
we
back
don't
to
even
Tom.
Believe in it anyway.
Let's get back to Tom Morello playing his tribute to Carlos Santana.
Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, and you riff rockers know that.
Yes, who was at the Kennedy Center Awards tonight, and one of the awardees was Carlos Santana. Tom Morello playing guitar, and I could not make out what he had on his guitar.
Okay.
To the point where something was written on it. To the point where I thought they're purposely not showing it because other people's guarantees and they showed the fingering and all that.
I guarantee you they didn't show it for that reason.
Right.
No question, because they know. He's on the watch list here.
Yes. Is he? I mean, for real?
Well, just kind of they know. They know he's an activist.
Well, the other thing, who funded the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts? David Koch of the infamous right-wing crazoid Koch
brothers. So he probably said, hey, watch that Morello.
Yeah, don't show his guitar.
He's going to pull some kind of shenanigans.
So I'm curious, I don't know. I mean, I was going to ask people how many people went to religious services, but that won't get us anywhere. I mean, probably just the people. All right, never mind.
Or the better question is, have you ever lied about how often you go to church?
Well, who would you lie to? Maybe your parents. You still going to church, son, now that you live in New York City? Oh, yeah, Dad, sure.
My parents know darn well I don't go.
Okay. So according to this article, Mr. Obama has gone to church 18 times during his nearly 5 years in the White House. And while his predecessor, Mr. Bush, attended 120 times during his 8 years in office.
Yeah.
Rumors that Obama was a pretend Christian or a Muslim Manchurian candidate. Everybody know what a Manchurian candidate is? This was, I don't even want to explain it. Look it up. It's in a movie.
I've seen the movie.
Great movie.
Yeah.
The original with, what was his name? Lawrence Harvey. Not Lawrence. Is that it? Is that an actor? Yeah. And Frank Sinatra. And then they did a remake with, was it Denzel Washington? I don't know. Anyway, So saying that he was a pretend Christian or a Muslim mentor and candidate fueled by his Kenyan background and his boyhood years in Indonesia that dogged him. A 2010 study by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life found that nearly 1 in 5 Americans, that's 20% of us, thought the president was a Muslim.
Oh, my gosh.
How many of these
people? I can't even take it.
How many of the 20%, what percent of the 20% do you think are right-wingers?
All.
Yeah. 43% they said they did not know what his religion was. Well, I don't really, nor do I care, nor should we even know. I thought this was a secular nation. What
can you imagine? When do you think the day will come that there is a Muslim president in the United States? Can you see that ever happening?
No.
I mean,
like 2340 or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. People close to the president say Mr. Obama's spiritual beliefs are profoundly held. In addition to the daily devotional he receives, which contains lines of scripture and quotations from people as wide-ranging as jazz singer Nina Simone and Johnny Cash. No wonder I don't know what his religion is.
I love Nina Simone and Johnny Cash.
You know who Mose Allison is? He was
a
white blues guy.
Yeah.
And he sang like the Who Do a song by him, Young Man Blues. And I had to take a friend of mine who was severely mentally disturbed into a mental institution one time, and it said religion. He put down Mose Allison.
I shouldn't laugh at the mentally ill, but that's kind of cute.
Every year on his birthday, Mr. whoever this is, said the president convenes a phone call with ministers, quote, to thank God for the year that was and pray for the year ahead. You know, I don't believe there's a bit of sincerity in Obama's religiosity any more than I did in Bush's. It's just all...
I think I respect the fact that he keeps it to himself more than Bush.
Yeah.
Bush would throw it in our faces.
All right. Right? Listen, we're going to do Duck Dynasty.
We're not going to do him.
Papa Robertson back on the show. But here, I wanted to throw this in because I wanted to just kind of rave about the Duck Dynasty. But there is this young woman, Kashama Sawant in Seattle. A 41-year-old economics teacher.
That's pretty young.
Well, that's what you say.
For a politician? Peter Worthy, bite your tongue.
An immigrant from India took a left at liberal and then kept on going all the way to socialism. And she, representing the Socialist Alternative Party, became one of the few elected socialists in the nation that she'll take a seat on Seattle's 9-member city council on January 1st. She embraces the label and asks her about almost any problem facing America today, and her answer will probably include the S-word, socialism, as the best and most reasonable response.
Ooh, those socialists are coming in.
Socialism is the path to real democracy. She says socialism protects the environment. Socialism is the best hope for young people who have seen their options crushed by the tide of low-wage, futureless jobs in the post-recession economy. Now, socialism doesn't have the same... power that it did
once
for a generation ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Socialism was synonymous with these police states that, I don't know whether you could actually call it, a lot of people call it state capitalism. The state was the boss.
Yeah.
The state owned everything. The state paid the wages, sold everything. Sounds like a big company to me.
Yeah, sure does.
And they had a police state in all of them. So not very admirable.
Right.
But they have closer to what could be socialism in the northern tier European countries, Denmark and Finland, Sweden, those folks. And I was reading through my friend's new book, Michael and Debbie Smith, who wrote this book, Imagine a Socialist USA. And I looked through it, and really, it's mostly liberal reforms, all of which I think almost everybody would agree to.
I don't know. I think we're so far on this side, we think that. But
yeah.
I doubt it, especially if you throw the S word in.
Well,
forget about it.
Here is this socialist. She said the take-home message for the left in general is that people are looking for alternatives. She had a victory over a veteran Democrat by a margin of 3,100 votes out of about 184,000 cast. And she said, if you ask me as a socialist what workers deserve, they deserve the value of what they produce. And for that, she said that she is going to introduce a bill that would result in a $15 an hour minimum wage in the city, matching the highest in the nation.
Yeah.
So it's just better pay. I mean, that unions do do that.
Yes,
and the mayor-elect, Ed Murray, a former state senator, said, and who was also a leader of the state's drive to allow same-sex marriage, promised support for an idea that was central to Shama Sawant's campaign. So the question is, while I go on to rave about Duck Dynasty, is would you vote for a socialist on the city council or a mayor in your city, particularly if they promise $15 an hour? So would you vote for a socialist? I'd do it in a second.
Well, sure, I sure would.
I'd put a sign on my lawn.
I know you would.
I'd put it for capitalists. Most of all the politicians I vote for are capitalists. So
you always have a sign in your yard of some sort or another.
I do. But anyway, it's 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
If you want to email an answer, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Would you vote for a socialist, particularly a local office, particularly if they were promising $15 an hour? Well, Duck Dynasty.
Oh, God.
So it's all been said and done, what Phil Robertson, the patriarch of the Klan, who this college-educated good old boy, who made some horrible remarks about gays and stupid, essentially racist remarks about the role of segregation when he was growing up. They were all happy and singing.
Everything was great under the Jim Crow laws.
Yeah.
Speak, white boy.
And by the way, if some of you, if you've seen Jim Crow laws, again, I always wonder as the years pass whether people know about all of these.
It's important for us to.
The segregation laws.
Yeah.
You know.
White only bathrooms, white only drinking fountains, white only restaurant, white only everything.
Was it one of our callers, an African American caller, or was it a comedian that said when he was young and he saw these drinking fountains that said colored only, he said, "Gee, man, we're special. We got our own drinking fountains."
Oh no, I think that was a comedian.
But all right, so in some ways, I think we've all been had. And a couple of you wrote in and someone called in saying you are do-, and I said this. I said we are doing them an incredible favor by doing
service,
so much mention.
Promoting them.
Yeah, any, you know, P.T. Barnum said any publicity is good publicity as long as they spell your name right, right? So, if you're interested in an ad on WRIF, call our ad department and get an idea what a minute costs. It ain't cheap, right?
Well, it depends on the day part.
Yes, day part, that's lingo, radio lingo.
Morning show, big bucks.
Yeah, right. So
Peter, Werby, and Julene, Jordan show, we can give you a really good rate.
Particularly for friends. But get this. So we gave Duck Dynasty, A&E, the cable network, tens of thousands of dollars worth of free publicity. And it paid off for them because in the week of December 7th, they increased their viewership from 11 million to 14 million.
My God.
So could we get a thank you letter for A&E, please?
And you're welcome.
And you know, and some of these people, remember I always say, deal them the cruelest blow of all, ignore them?
Yeah.
The reason I didn't ignore them is because of how vicious a statement this Phil Robertson uttered about gays, right at a time where even Utah is allowing same-sex marriage. And we are in this epochal change. An epoch is ending and a new one is beginning. And we're extending the American Revolution, liberty and justice for all, not some.
That was written a long time ago,
too. Yeah, and it wasn't all meant then, but now it is. You know, all men are created equal. Now it's all people are created equal. So this is happening, and this is the extension, and this has been a big fight. I mean, we began with just free white, property-owning males could vote, and we extended everything in rights and liberties increasingly to everybody because what happened was, is that democracy and the democratic revolutions of the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries, they let the cat out of the bag. We're all equal. That rulers are not divine. We're not subjects. We're citizens. Citizens have inalienable rights. Now, these conservatives all throughout American history and world history fought like hell to keep it privileged, and usually for those folks, at least some variety to. I mean, the conservatives now, they don't want to have it. Well, I don't know. Maybe I don't think they have, at least, just white property males. But a lot of them, I'm sure, wouldn't mind going back to them, particularly the ones with property. So a neighbor of mine, I said something about Duck Dynasty, and she said, Duck Die Nasty. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And I think, well, and here's what I thought. These people are dying off. These stupid racists and these ignorant homophobes, they're gone.
It's a new day and age.
Yeah, it's a new day and age, but they are going to die nasty in two ways. They're going to make people suffer as much as they can on the way out, and they are going to die being nasty. Yeah, they're never going to have a warm heart for everybody. Boy, they got the warmest heart in the world for their kin and their family and all that.
Do you have what's your compassion level
for
these people?
I'm
serious. Yeah. What is your level of compassion, Peter, for these people?
Oh, well.
I mean, we try to muster compassion with everybody.
You know, the Buddhist concept of compassion means that there's a perfect human nature, a Buddhist nature, which is perfect. And when you commit acts that violate that, you become less of a human being. And in that
less
regard,
enlightened, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you can have compassion in that sense. So you have compassion with serial killers and people that A-bomb cities and march people off to a Holocaust without having any sympathy for them or their acts.
It's a difference.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't spend a lot of time with compassion for people that are making their problems socially and psychologically other people's problems, and in fact, historically making generations of people, having really bad problems.
Well, and the fact that this family and this man in particular has this huge wave of support. Who are these people?
You know what?
If
there was somebody that had a credible, a charismatic personality, and I'm not putting this on Robertson or anything, but if there was a credible fascist response, classic fascist, like in Europe, a Mussolini or a Hitler or a Franco, something like that, a third of the population in every Western industrial country is flat out fascist, racist, nationalistic, militaristic.
I tell you, on my Facebook page, when I see people posting support for this guy, guess what? Bye-bye.
You can defriend him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
See you later. I don't have time for you. I can't even look at that without feeling sick.
All right. Got some people beginning to line up. David, we're going to take you first, but you might have to hold on. Other lines open. First off, would you vote for a socialist that has been elected to Seattle City Council? And she says she's going to make $15 an hour, the wage there in Seattle. But anyway, the duck.
Oh, did she say that, too? That's what she wants?
She's going to introduce it.
Oh, okay, because you said she was going to make $15 an hour.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Oh.
I know. I shouldn't leave you at midnight. But
she's a politician. She's probably going
to
make more than that. But so the Duck Dynasty is had their viewership increased from 11 million to 14 million. So could it possibly be that A&E said, what are we going to do
when he goes off. When this guy goes crazy.
In general, or just a specific interview goes, and they say, you know what? We're going to suspend him. There'll be this incredible nationwide condemnation. Then there'll be this enormous support from all the creatures of the right, like Sarah Palin and what have you. And then we'll say, we made a mistake, and we're listening to our listeners. And in the meantime, we'll probably get a million more viewers for the Duck Dynasty. Well, instead, they got another 3 million because everybody I know said, I never even saw that. And some people never heard of it even.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. Any publicity is good publicity. And so after we probably increased their listenership for the next one by, 10,000 or something like that. I've never seen it.
And I never have either. And
I've seen clips from it.
I had no idea what it was until I went down to, like I told you, I can't remember the boat show or one of these shows down at Cobo. And I said, what is that line for? And someone said, oh, that's for those guys from Duck Dynasty. I'm like, Duck what?
Right.
Didn't know. And you know what? I'm glad I didn't know.
Well, here's what in Variety, the magazine of the newspaper of the entertainment industry, said the network might have acted precipitously, I mean too quickly, by suspending Phil Robertson for his inflammatory remarks regarding gays and equally insensitive ones about African Americans in the Jim Crow era South. it clearly didn't have an end game in mind. And once the network demonstrated that it was displeased with Robertson's statements, unless it was truly willing to strangle their golden goose, there was really nowhere to go from there. So it, I don't want to get into conspiracies. Should we?
Yeah, because we're not conspiracy-like really here. You and
we're
I.
Not?
No.
Don't you think it was a conspiracy with the Kennedy assassination?
Well, Peter, I mean,
you think Oswald was the lone assassin?
I don't even care.
Up on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and also the Night Call Facebook page, I got a guy up there that said there were six shooters.
We're not, in Dallas?
No, the Duck Dynasty. No, in Dallas, right.
What? Oh, God, don't confuse me.
So here, so the network issued a mealy-mouthed statement Friday promising to run a public service campaign about tolerance and inclusiveness.
See, now that's how easily they can brush it off. Hey, listen, hey, editing, hey, writing, hey, editing, we need you to put something real good together,
right,
and then we can just breeze on over this thing.
And here's what Variety says, this writer: one suspects the network will also be less eager to arrange interview opportunities for Robertson, which, of course, won't prevent him from going out and speaking his mind, especially, now here's a very important line, especially now that he is a hero to many conservatives.
Ooh, oh, God.
Now, I don't get it. This guy makes bigoted remarks that essentially, in the full meaning of the term, dehumanizing our gay brothers and sisters.
Yep.
And if you, and every gay, well, I don't know, every single one, but lots of gay men and women have brothers and sisters and what have you. So fellow human beings, fellow inhabitants of the planet. So he makes these bigoted remarks that actually set the context for violence against gays, which is still a problem, and stupid racist ones about African-American, and he's a hero to many conservatives?
I can't even deal with it.
I mean, conservatism is so corrupt that it defies the imagination that there are a few people of some substance that adhere to it.
And they admit, they're admitting that they are homophobes and that they are racist. They're admitting it by supporting this guy.
And as
my
friend said,
are we going too far? Tell us.
Yeah.
Because I don't think so.
And as my friend said, this is Duck Dynasty, and these people are going to die nasty, and but they're out of here. To repeat, let's say the obvious, those who turned this into a free speech crusade clearly had a political agenda, the right-wingers. Robertson had every right to express his opinions, and the network was free to distance himself from those remarks and from him, and if they feel his statements as someone affiliated with A&E damaged his brand and its image. But, you know.
Well, I'm writing them a letter.
Go ahead.
I'm going to email them. I'm going to do it tomorrow.
We got to take a break, but let me just quickly. A&E also appeared not to anticipate the blowback from those who share Robertson's views and how suspending him would be perceived among religious conservatives who already feel besieged by popular culture. Let's see. People who regularly complain about having relatively few options on TV where the characters profess to share their values. Well, other than this one, I don't think they'd be very popular. Let's see. Still, that percentage of us who think gays are less than human and problems in the South during that era were due to northern agitators. So there's still that percentage. Die nasty!
And evolve already! crying out loud.
We're going to take a break. Vote for a socialist? Would you do that? And we'll be back to talk about Pussy Riot.
And we're going to take David from Detroit's phone call first.
Yeah.
We promised him. We're going to get you on.
Okay.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
My mom is my hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. She helps them get out, even when she can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My mom is a firefighter, but the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
101 WRIF, locking in everything that rocks.
Contest to nominate a high school student for the Kakaris Family Dentistry Brush with Greatness program. Your nominee can be featured in a radio ad and win prizes, including a $100 Dick's Sporting Goods gift certificate. More info at WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
And you can reach us at 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743 and calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And we got something, an email, and it's all it said was, I'm thinking liberty. And it's a, here, look at this, Peter. It's a cool picture. This guy with a mohawk, and he's thinking.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I like it.
And thank you, Robert. Robert wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And we were talking about Tom Morello, the guitarist for Rage Against the Machine. And he performed tonight at the Kennedy Center Awards tribute to Santana. And he had something written on his guitar, and they just
wouldn't show it.
You know what it said, according to Robert? Arm the homeless.
Okay, and in the 2 minutes I had to think about this is what I've come up with. He is basically, in a way, talking about guns and, you know, what's more important. Do you know what I'm saying? As he's a songwriter, so he's not saying literally arm the homeless.
I'm just looking at you.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and they wouldn't show it, and I actually thought it said homeless. Maybe it wouldn't have said harm the homeless.
Right? No. Hell no.
What does it mean? Like, my wife used to wear a pin with a picture of a bear, and it said, support the right to arm bears.
I think that's the
yeah,
gist.
Yeah, so it's like that?
Yes.
It's like that. Okay. All right, so I'm done talking about the Duck Dynasty people.
Unless people want to
talk about it.
I mean, the way we berated people who support Duck Dynasty, I can't blame anyone for not calling us about it.
Yeah, and they are.
Although we love a lively debate.
We do, yeah. And the other question, would you vote for a socialist like the people of Seattle did, where Shami Sawant now sits on the city council, will as of January 1st, and she's going to introduce a bill for a $15 minimum wage in the city. All right. But in the meantime, you call, and we will talk to David in Detroit. David, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
I heard the ding. Okay, so I called you last week, and you guys were talking about Duck Dynasty, and I didn't want to comment on it. I just didn't know enough about it. But after your call, we hung up. The next day I got up, and I decided to look into this guy a little bit more because I knew nothing about him, don't watch the show, don't even own a TV.
Really?
So I looked up some YouTube videos where he did some personal interviews about his personal thoughts. I saw some public speaking engagements and also looked at the article in question and that people are talking about. So I don't know that I agree that he's a racist bigot based on what I saw besides the interview. As a matter of fact, I heard quite the opposite from not only his words, but from people around him discussing how he has gone on publicly and privately about how he despises racism.
Well, of course they're going to say that. I mean,
he's also said that in public venues that are recorded, that are out there, that you can access. And,
Send us one. You know, I want to see it.
Well, I mean, I believe that they're there, but I think he was just trying to, cover his butt. I mean, who in the world would say that in the Jim Crow era, that there was black people were happy and he never heard them complaining and what have you? I mean, that's a tremendously stupid thing to say, don't you think?
Can I tell you how I took that?
Okay.
And I'll tell you what. And I'm no way comparing what we go through today as a society with slavery. But, you know, have you ever heard the term that you and I are slaves to money today?
Yeah. You know, slaves to the
okay,
man.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. And I'm just simply saying that, you know, there are people in this day and age today that are just, you know, they're miserable because they know they're being screwed by either taxes, they have, you know, bad standard of living, whatever. In no way does it completely compare to what folks went through during the slavery days. I understand that, okay? But could you agree that even during, like, today or back then, when people went through their strife, that they did have moments of happiness? I mean, were they miserable 20?
Well, of course, and maybe...
Slaves? Is he talking about slaves?
Well, there... Listen, it wasn't...
They had to create their own happiness.
Well, they did.
Sure,
yeah. But let's do this. let's do this.
Oh.
I am always about giving people the benefit of the doubt. And although I don't, in this case, if you want to, that's good. Tell me about voting for a socialist, though. That was the other thing you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, and then and one other real quick on this thing is that I really think like his viewpoints really do, and I feel it when I hear his when I hear him talking, that it really is coming out of his religious convictions, which you and I, we can disagree with that, but if it's coming based on his religious beliefs, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That is what the Bible says, and whether we agree with it or not, that's basically what he's basing that on. But I'll digress.
Well, before you do, I tend to agree with that, that a reading of the Bible certainly is, I mean, all liberal Christians, I know tons of liberal Christians that support marriage equality, that support, you know, rights for gays, all of that, and they're trying to make, I guess, ultimately something out of the Bible that it isn't. I mean, the Bible also justifies slavery. It was used by the slave owners.
See, just another thing that's wrong with it. I'm sorry. I just have no tolerance, zero, period.
Okay, socialism.
Yeah, I think in the beginning you had mentioned $15 an hour. Would you vote for a socialist if they could give you $15 an hour? And I didn't hear. I wasn't sure if you meant minimum wage. And
minimum
then I think
wage.
You went
yeah.
back and said, okay, well, you know, I'll answer it this way. Why not go $30 an hour? I mean, people work hard. Let's let them have a little extra in life.
Hey, we're down with that.
That's okay. That's a, you Bring know, it. You're if you're more radical than her, cool.
No. But the point was, is at what point do you say enough's enough? Is there a level for the two of you where you say, yeah, you know, that's a little bit too much?
Well, I think there has to be some.
Yes, we do. And it's called the fat cats that are making all this money.
Yeah.
All these CEOs making all these money, getting these giant bonuses. Yes, too much. The Walmart family, the Waltons, yep, too much.
Yeah, sure. The Waltons could afford to pay its associates $30 an hour. Then you and I wouldn't have to subsidize them through, because so many of them, or almost all of them, are eligible for Medicaid and other social services. I mean, the six Waltons have more wealth than the bottom third of the rest of the country. Now, how do you come to a point where, in fact, that you make commerce viable? That is to say, if you said, okay, everybody's got to make $50 an hour, and then so you'd put like tons of little businesses, they'd go out of business. They couldn't afford to pay the wages. So there's got to be some, other than the market, the so-called free market just winds up screwing everybody. The freer the market is, the more people get screwed, and all you got to do is go back to the 19th century when there was no controls whatsoever on employers and particularly big companies and these emerging corporations. So we want to have some social standard by which we make those determinations. And you say, well, you know, you got these bureaucratic decisions and someone's going to get hurt. Always. In mass situations, someone's always going to get a short end of the stick. More people get a short end of the stick when there's no control, no regulation of the big giants of this economy, when they're not regulated, when there's not a demand. I mean, what kind of company that's making billions, that its owners, which have never worked a decent day in their life, the Waltons here for Walmart, and they have more wealth than the bottom 30% of Americans. How do they go to sleep every night and think they are making life miserable for their employees?
They've got 2,000 thread count Egyptian silk sheets. They're fine. They go to sleep just fine.
And you know what? You can find you'll find Walmart associates that'll say, oh, I love my job. And I remember an essay once. It was called The Morale of the Cheerful Robot.
Ooh.
All right, my friend. Happy New Year to you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's go to Natalie. Natalie is in Beaverton. Beaverton is where?
Beaverton is up by Gladwin, Michigan.
Oh, okay. Welcome. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you. And we listened quite a bit. I just had a couple of questions. The first thing I wanted to say, though, was I was totally against what Phil Robertson said. My husband and I don't believe in bigotry. We think it's ridiculous. But my question is I was listening a few weeks ago to your sister station, and David Demar said a couple things about guys wearing makeup and avoiding them at the bar and stay clear of them.
I got to tell you, Natalie, this is really inappropriate for discussion, particularly talking about personnel on another station and all that. So do me a favor. I'll be glad to write back to you, but write in to me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and we can try to deal with that. Okay? Thank you. I appreciate you understanding why I'm doing this. All right. Bye. Let's see here. Here is Chris. Chris is in Sterling Heights. Thanks for calling 248-544-WRIF.
Hi, how are you?
How's it going, Chris?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
We're good.
Good. What's
up? Good, good, good. Well, I just want to make a comment with the Duck Dynasty, the man who came back. I understand that he came back with a reason, and with that reason is through redemption. And I also heard that there'll be some commercials in regards with gay rights.
Yeah.
On the station, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's something. Yeah, I think that's something that is good. I think people make a mistake when they make certain remarks, and I think redemption is a good thing. And I think a lot of us forget that when people say things out of text or out of, for lack of a better word, common sense, that we think that they're all of a sudden on the other side. What I'm trying to say is that we're all in it, and we all are accountable to saying things that we really don't mean.
Well, I wonder, I mean, maybe the stereotype.
I think he meant it.
Yeah. Here, let me, well, you know, there is an article that we got. Duck Dynasty uproar divides gay conservatives. So there, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it seems like an oxymoron, to tell you the truth, given that, that the Republican Party and conservatives are the home of homophobes. But, you know, he got, there was like a quarter of a million people signed an online petition started by the group Faith Driven Consumer demanding Robertson's return to the show, which I think means that they didn't do it because he was, repent? Did you say that?
Well, I said redemption.
Redemption, yeah.
Redemption, yeah. I think that exists on both sides, both the left and the right. I think both parties are capable of saying things that they really, truly don't mean.
Well, tell me.
The left side too.
Well, I would say, I mean, I don't want to defend anything. There's some pretty, I don't want to get into it. But mostly what we think as of the public left in this country, you know, which is mostly liberal and barely left of center, I don't think you find anything like the continuing disparaging of people that you find from the public conservatives.
Well, actually, I work for a right-hand group, and they've apologized to me when I was first hired, and I'm still with them. So I have to say that I've worked for a right-handed group for a long time. They're very good with me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they did it for a reason because of whatever legal technicality they were going to be up against.
Right.
And I can tell you that I've worked with a great group of people, but they are very right-wing.
Yeah.
Well, I hope they love you, Chris.
All right, Chris. Thank you very much for your opinion. Appreciate that.
Yes.
Governor Blobley, yeah, I love that. Bobby Jindal, who's a Republican governor, says, I remember when the TV networks believed in the First Amendment.
What?
Where was I when he said that? What about Bill Maher in 2001 who said, somebody or maybe the President Bush or something said that the people that attacked us on 9/11 were cowards, and Maher said that he thought their act was despicable, but was the last thing in the world. It was cowardly. And you could go on.
He got suspended, right?
He got fired. I wonder where all these conservatives were defending him at that time.
Yeah,
right. I don't think so. Pussy Riot!
What? Oh, God, you just like saying it.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, it's the name of a Russian band, all-female punk band. A couple of the members have been in prison, and they just got out. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, they're in prison, two members of the punk band Pussy Riot. You know, but that word and what it colloquially means also, besides just a little cat, goes way back. I mean, 40 years or so. They're in a James Bond film when, what was the
Pussy
first?
Galore.
Pussy Galore, yeah. And everybody yucked it up. But now, tell me the experience of hearing it on the news.
Oh, well, yeah, I was watching one of the morning news shows, national shows, and they cut over to this kind of conservative-looking white guy in Russia, and it was so funny to see him say, and two members of the band Pussy Riot. I literally almost fell out of bed. It was so funny.
You can go to my website, and there's a link to the film about it. Now, here's what was going on, that they were imprisoned for at least a year, or was it 2 years here? But they got released by... boy, I've got too much information here. Ready? You ready for it?
Peter,
you're ready?
You
okay.
Know the story.
I know the story, yes, exactly. I'll just read it. How about that? 4 days after the release from a Russian prison, two members of the punk band Pussy Riot gave their first news conference to emphasize they were starting a human rights organization in Russia while sticking by the message that put them in jail, ending the presidency of Vladimir V. Putin. And what happened was they went into this church in Moscow and performed, I forgot what it was, like 85 seconds of this song. And for that, they were accused of hooliganism based on antipathy towards religion. And there is a...
They were sentenced to 2 years.
Well, yeah, it was a two-year sentence on the charges of hooliganism motivated by religious hatred.
Hooliganism.
And, you know, so were the Greenpeace people that were arrested in Russia protesting the oil extraction up in the North Sea. Wherever it is up there. But there's a film called Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer, which is pretty incredible.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I did. I have. But the activists, Maria Alyokhina.
You can do this.
And Nadezhda Tolonokhina.
Fail.
What is it? Tolonokhina.
Yes.
Tolokhina. And another woman were arrested last year after performing a crude anti-Putin song on the altar of a Moscow cathedral. Probably pretty, you know, not good to do when dominated by a very conservative religious establishment.
Well, you know, those punkers.
Anyway, the first public screening in Russia of this documentary about Pussy Riot was canceled by the government, and this is just yesterday, Saturday. Yeah, we're still at it. This is Sunday. The film Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer, was to have been screened in Moscow on Sunday afternoon, less than a week after two members of Pussy Riot, they sure say this a lot, don't they, of Pussy Riot were released
like
from
too.
Prison. Yeah. Their two-year sentence is on charges of hooliganism motivated by religious hatred for performing a protest song at a Moscow cathedral was committed under an amnesty. Commuted, their sentence was, under an amnesty from the Kremlin on Monday, along with 25,000 other people. And it's out there. And you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, look in the right-hand column, and you'll see a link to it. Oh, yeah, by the way, I think it's on HBO.
But you said you can see it online.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
You can
Google that sucker.
Yeah.
You find it.
Yeah. So you're only going to be with us another couple of minutes.
Couple minutes.
Huh?
I know. I want to keep going, but I just.
Well, why don't I do this?
You
this
have a whole pile of stuff to
talk
about.
Yeah, this seems like a natural point to do a break.
Okay.
But maybe what I will do, because I usually do this when we come back, talking about the second hour of what we're going to have on, when you're gone. Boy, that sounds ominous, doesn't it?
Yeah. But I'll be back next week for the whole show, I promise.
Well, we'll see you next year.
Yes, for sure, Peter. And it'll be another great year of Night Call. Well, yes. I don't know where you're going. First of all, I don't know what you're doing. Yes, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Right.
Thank you for listening.
At 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing James Stair. He's a founder of something called Common Sense Media, and this is Talking Back to Facebook, the Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. But it really applies to all of us as well. I saw a 13-year-old on the NBC Nightly News yesterday, I think it was, saying that Facebook is
over.
Over.
Now, also, we're interviewing an author of a book about medical marijuana.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, my sister, as we speak, is on a plane with Willie Nelson.
There you go.
Hawaii to Dallas.
Martin Lee was the author of Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. Talking about the role of cannabis in American society and the new medical potential through one of its properties.
Look forward to that. I'll be asleep, but I'll check it out on the podcast.
You can. We'll have the podcast up. Yeah, we missed last night. All right, so when we come back, I want to talk about the 7 ripoffs that capitalists would like to keep out of the media. And this will blow your mind. I mean, we're scrambling around for some of our least advantaged citizens with unemployment and food stamps and all. And, you know, where is the money?
And all those people getting kicked off now.
Yeah, it's terrible. We'll talk about that, too. Do you want to call in the meantime? Well, here's Mr. Announcer.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. Peter and Jaleen will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Wait, what?
Everything that rocks.
I want to hit the river!
Jaleen, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Actually, it's just Peter. Good night, Jaleen. Jaleen's got to work on our sister station at like 9 in the morning, and she's been working night, day after day after day. Yeah, go home, will you? She's gone. Wow, suddenly it's very quiet in here. It's all alone. Just you and me, so give me a call. Peter Werby with you on Night Call at 248-544-WRIF. Now, this was just sent to me, and it's from the Daily Kos, K-O-S. One of the things is, bigoted conservative hero of Duck Dynasty tells men to marry 15-year-olds. I have to look at that later. But what this article is essentially about is, wait a minute, what is NSFW? I should know that. In this extremely funny and NSFW rant, my new pal Dusty truly cuts the chase on this entire Duck Dynasty free the hate speech in a way that no one else has before. First, he points out the obvious that A&E have every right to hire, suspend, and fire anyone they feel like, particularly if they think the person has damaged their corporate brand. But I got to say, as I did say, that you know, who knows? This worked out really well for A&E. Let me also quickly mention the Duck Dynasty creator Scott Gurney appears to have appeared in an indie gay porn film in the past, so either is gay or is sympathetic enough to be capable for playing gay on film, and therefore if anyone has the right to feel he doesn't need to be put up with Robertson's comment, it might be just someone like him. Let me see. Dusty then points out some obvious things, such as the fact that Phil Robertson is rich, and although Jesus didn't say anything definitive about gays, he did talk about the rich, as we know. It wasn't a big fave. You know, the whole thing about harder for a rich man to get into heaven than a, what, camel to get through an eye of a needle. Just, you know what, I am going to have to review this, because this is this long thing about Jesus and the kingdom of God. Oh, man. Wow. No, this is, I'm going to put this up on the website. But, and it shows all the brothers in school who are just these yuppies, right? Before reality TV, they're just these handsome-looking rich kids, right? And oh, no. This is, you won't, wait till I get this up. This is all the boys, and they this is absolutely amazing. All right, I guess I should shut up about it unless I can show it to you about how they've altered their appearance for this reality show. But hey, as actually what the person said is, they're actors. They're actors. And think about some of the dumbass things that actors have said. And, you know, sometimes it does, in fact, work to their advantage. All right, let's go on. Nobody wants to address this. Maybe I'm beating a dead horse. That's an awful image, isn't it? But in any event, here's the socialist that got elected to the Seattle City Council, and I'm wondering whether that the label socialist still kind of sends up the, if you will, red flags the way that did a generation and two generations ago, or you just say, wow, someone's willing to suggest $15 an hour for working people, and what that would do positively for the economy and for these individual people's lives. Would you vote for him? I sure would. All right, let's go to Bob in Wayne. Bob, thanks for calling 248-544-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. You want to address socialism?
Yeah.
Obama is not a socialist. He's flat out a communist.
Why? Why do you think that?
And because I know.
I know you know. But I'm wondering, usually when, you know, you have to give, like, reasons or explanations or proofs.
When Marines talk to you, they know what you're doing. Usually.
Well, I'm glad you had at least some little, yeah, usually. Yeah, but what?
Yes, I've done a lot of stuff I can't talk about on the air. But
that makes you less interesting as a caller. But tell me, what attributes do Barack Obama have that makes him a communist?
He has done nothing for this country except mess it up.
Okay, but that doesn't make him a communist. That makes him inept, incompetent. Someone who...
A socialist is a communist.
Okay, but you said he didn't do anything, so he hasn't brought any socialism into the country, right? I mean, socialists aren't communists. In fact, if you could look back on history, one of the things that the communists always did was to kill and imprison socialists and liberals, just like the fascists did. You know,
and to kill the sitting president. I'm not threatening that.
What?
He needs to be talked to.
Wait a minute, Bob. This is a show about ideas. You said the man was a communist, then you went back and said he was a socialist, and then you said he hasn't done anything. So if he hasn't done anything, what has he done that shows that he's a socialist or a communist? I mean, what was Herbert Hoover, who was president in 1928 when the stock market crashed, and he didn't do anything to end the Depression. I mean, he wasn't a socialist or a communist. He was incompetent. He was inept.
A socialist takes over power by the vote, which he didn't get reelected by the popular vote.
Bob, we've got a real factual problem going here. So I'm going to end this call, say thank you very much. You got to go look up some of this stuff. He won the popular vote. He was the first president to win a popular vote in a majority in I don't know how long. All right. Thanks, Bob. Whew. I mean, how do people get on the air and talk nonsense? God. Here's Kevin and Wayne. Kevin, hi. You're on the air.
Hey.
Hey. What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to propose a libertarian approach to socialism.
Sure.
You know, just defund the federal government. You know, they take less. They lower their taxes substantially. Maybe even eventually cutting out the federal income tax completely. That would enable the states to make their own decisions much more, to tax at a higher rate, and they could establish actual socialism. And then when we have, I feel like...
Well, wait. Are there any historic models for this?
I feel like we have a much better chance of having, say, four or five smart governors than we have a chance of having one smart president.
Yeah, it hasn't worked out well over the last 40 years or so. But are there any historic models for what you're suggesting? You know, I mean, kind of end income tax, federal government intervention and all that. There is, I got to tell you, so maybe I should let you answer, but I'll tell you, there is. It's called the 19th century, right? Then there was no income tax, there were no minimum wage, there was no EPA, there was no Food and Drug Administration, there was nothing.
Very low technology.
What's that?
Very low technology.
Well, it was enough to, it was absolutely enough to allow the poisoning of the land, the air, and the water. I mean, if you look at Pittsburgh and steel production, coal mining, all of that, I mean, these guys would have continued to work kids in mills 10 hours, 12 hours a day if it wouldn't have been for the intervention of the federal government. And, you know, when we start leaving things to states, we have things like slavery, right? I mean, what if a state, Mississippi might say, hey, I think we're going to put back slavery. It worked all right because Phil Robertson said they was all happy back then.
Of course, you can still have the federal regulatory of, no, you can't have slaves.
No, that's good.
I mean, that's a simple value of human, I mean, that's covered by human liberties, so, I mean, that is a libertarian.
Right, but back in the 19th century, the libertarians always talk about the free market. So, labor under capitalism is a commodity that's sold. You and I sell our labor. And when it's left to the free market, it goes down to, you know, only to what's called a subsistence wage, which we're heading for with a lot of people in this country now as well. And two things that moved up the standard of living of the larger population. And one were unions that, by having contracts, artificially raised the selling price of labor. Artificially raised it. Because if you left it at the market value, people would be working 10 and 12 hours a day. And when you compress the number of hours that a boss is able to have you for a day, that too is essentially the same thing. I mean, it's a redistribution of wealth, because if you can get paid say the equivalent of $3 an hour in today's wages and have to put in 10-12 hour days, the owner makes one amount. If you got to pay the worker seven and a quarter or better, $15 an hour, and then have to pay time and a half for overtime and double time if, you know, you don't get on your seventh day, well, you know, then that is less for the boss and more for the worker. It also makes people's life a little more decent, so they're not just things that get ground up by, as you know, you said, the kind of technology that they had back then. The other thing was the minimum wage that, again, artificially set the standard of labor, that what labor is paid, right?
Yeah. What? I mean, sure. you can argue that. I don't really have a strong view on minimum wage. I think that labor is still sold based on supply and demand.
Well, no. If it is in supply and demand, then the market determines it. And if the market determines it, listen, there's 11 million people out of work. If it wasn't for the minimum wage, and if it wasn't for unions, the little bits of them that remain, and you said there were no unions, no minimum wage, and people would be working for $3 an hour, without a doubt.
I doubt it. I mean, I don't work for minimum wage, but, I mean, I don't make enough. I mean, I make less than I deserve, but I don't get minimum wage. I get above minimum wage.
What kind of what industry are you in, or what kind of business or whatever?
I work in a warehouse.
Okay. Well, I don't know. And you're not union?
No, I'm not union.
Okay. If you were a Teamster, you would, in the power that they have left, you would make significantly more. It wouldn't be that the boss would want to do that. It would be that the workers combined. You know, there used to be laws against that in the early 19th century. It was called anti-combination laws, that workers could not combine. They had to, it was the libertarian dream. It was you as an individual making the decision about where you worked, and so if you said to the boss, hey, I want a dime more an hour, and he said no, and you'd say, okay, I'm taking my labor somewhere else. Well, of course, it didn't work, because there's always a surplus labor force. And now there's 11 million people out there, and probably good numbers of them. If you said to them, hey, would you work for $6 an hour? Well, they'd say, well, the Republicans just yanked my unemployment extension, and I can't get food stamps, so yeah, I'll work for $6 an hour. So you don't want the minimum wage. I'm sorry, you want the minimum wage. You do not want a free market. A free market also means limited government regulation, which means that food can be adulterated, that there's no safety standards, all of that. So capitalism, left to its own devices, is concerned with one thing: profit. Profit only. And if to make more profit, you got to really hurt people, generations of workers, ruin their lives with miserable working conditions and low wages, then they do it. And as I always say, when you start to combine, they call it the National Guard, the Pinkertons, the company goons, the local cops, and shoot women and children down so they won't be able to artificially raise the price of their labor. And they're doing it not because oh, my God, that will take so much money away from me. I won't be able to do this or that. It's just because they have this sense of greedy entitlement. All these conservatives always raving about entitlements. The real people who think they're entitled to run the world, the masses of the universe, are the 1%. All right, Kevin, I got to move on. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let me see. That was the old number. 248-544-WRIF. And here's Ron in Shelby. Ron, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good. What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment about that caller that called in saying Obama is a communist.
Yeah.
He is absolutely right, whether you want to believe it or not. Obama grew up communism, studying communism. Do you know who Obama's real father is?
Joseph Stalin.
Frank Marshall Davis.
let me just tell people. This is another canard, in my opinion. The person that Ron is mentioning was a black nationalist and a communist. I may have been a communist. I don't know. And so what they're putting out there, that this was his real father. Well, I don't know. That's like saying he's not a citizen. That's like saying he's a Muslim.
His real father. It's been proven.
It hasn't been proven. It's been wait. It's been asserted. It has been asserted. He has a birth certificate.
New World Order.
Yep. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. I'm still looking for something here that I can't seem to find, but all right, we'll go on. Here are the big capitalist ripoffs that they don't want you to know about. Pardon me. Corporations profit from food stamps. It's odd to think about a $1 billion financial institution objecting to cuts in the food stamp program, but some of them are administrators of the program, collecting fees from a benefit meant for children and other needy Americans, and enjoying subsidies of state tax money for that could be performed by the states themselves. They want more people on food stamps, not less. Three corporations have cornered the market. Guess who? J.P. Morgan, Xerox, and eFunds Corporation. You know, now, that probably... I don't think that's real self-explanatory there, to tell you the truth. But I don't want to just, pardon me, go on with all of it here. Crash the economy, get your money back, die with a student loan, stay in debt. This one will make a lot of sense, particularly to some of you students. The financial industry has manipulated the bankruptcy laws to ensure that high-risk derivatives, which devastated the market in 2008, and here this is because there is not enough regulation on the banks, have first claim over savings, deposit, insurance, pension funds, and everything else. And this is what was going on in Detroit. Detroit's complicated. It's not working out like that entirely. Some of these companies have decided to take less. But in general, that's what it is. The same banker-friendly bankruptcy reform has ensured that college graduates keep their student loans till they die, and sometimes even that after that, as the debt is assumed by their co-signing parents. Here's another thing. These are seven ripoffs that capitalists would like to keep out of the media. Almost 70% of corporations are not required to pay any federal taxes. Where do we, they always, you know, these Republicans say, where are we going to get the money to give this extension to, you know, to these unemployed people? 11 million that they're supposed to go find work. And if they didn't have unemployment benefits, including to this screwy conservative notion, if they weren't being paid by the state and by the federal government, that they would go out and get work. There's not 11 million jobs out there. There's like three people looking for every job that exists. In a good economy, there's one-to-one. let me see. Oh, yeah, 70% don't pay taxes. And that's even before tax avoidance kicks in. The non-taxable designation exempts 70% of U.S. corporations from taxes. The Wall Street Journal, a friend of Big Capital, says the percentage of U.S. corporations organized as non-taxable businesses has grown from 24% in 1986 to 70% in 2008. The percentage of all firms is far higher than partnerships and sole proprietorships, blah, blah, blah. Four is lotteries pay for corporate tax avoidance. This means revenue comes from the poorest residents of a community rather than from billion-dollar corporations. They're not paying any taxes, right? Many of the lottery players don't realize how bad the odds are. Fill out $2 tickets for 12 hours a day for 50 years, and you'll have half a chance of winning. Doesn't mean you'll have 50% chance of winning. Some astonishing facts reveal the extent of the problem. Low-income households spend anywhere from 5 to 9% of their earnings on lotteries. And a lot of people go, oh, you know, they're bad habits. Well, it is a bad habit, but it's born out of desperation of poverty. So they found that nearly half of low-income residents plan to gamble at a newly opened casino in Pennsylvania. America's gambling losses in 2007, losses were 9 times greater than just 25 years ago. Now, here's a big one. I don't know why this wasn't number one. The National Football League pays no federal taxes. They pay no federal taxes. One of the most profitable organizations in America, with billions in tickets, TV rights, merchandise sales, and with an NFL commissioner who earned more money than the CEOs of Walmart, Coca-Cola, and AT&T, is considered a nonprofit. It has tax-exempt status. Why is this? Because that's what Congress declared. It gets even worse. While the individual teams themselves are not exempt from federal taxes, they enjoy multi-million-dollar subsidies from their states and cities, as we've just seen in Detroit, for their new and refurbished stadium. Fans and non-fans of the names all the teams, are among those who pay our tax money for those downtown football fields. New Orleans taxpayers paid for leather stadium seats. For the Dallas Cowboys, a $6 million property tax bill was waived. I mean, the idea is it's going to be good for the economy. And there's debate about that, whether it actually works out. And if some of these billionaires, like the Illiches, were really good citizens of Detroit, why wouldn't they say, we will pay our fair share, and we don't need public financing? Why doesn't he just write a check if he's a billionaire? And it's done. All right, here of the number six of the seven big ripoffs the capitalists don't want known in the media. Live on Park Avenue in New York, get a farm subsidy. A disturbing but fascinating report called Farm Subsidies and Big Dogs list, here are the cities that get the biggest farm subsidies. Ready for this? New York City, big farming area. Chicago, same thing. Washington, D.C. In New York, many entities receive federal subsidies at their downtown office buildings, such as 30 Rockefeller Plaza, or at their million-dollar residential condos. In Chicago, nearly every neighborhood in the city receives federal farm subsidy payments. In Washington, even U.S. senators are receiving farm subsidy checks. Perhaps more of us should become farmers. In Florida, according to Forbes magazine, anyone could legally qualify their land as farmland by stocking it with a few cows. Wealthy heir Mark Rockefeller received $342,000 to not farm to allow his Idaho land to return to its natural state. In the meantime, we're cutting people off of food stamps, or decreasing them, humiliating them by saying they have to take drug tests and all this, and cutting off people's unemployment insurance. And the Republicans say, well, we'll give back, here's what we'll do, here's our blackmail plan. We'll give back this money for food stamps, but you have to make cuts in other parts of the budget. Well, they could get it from these people, and they could get it from the corporations that don't pay taxes, but since they, you know, love the rich, they're the whores, if you will, for the wealthy, you could do it easily with the military budget. Over $500 billion this year alone. So we can stick our noses all around the world, get more people killed, kill more people, and create the context for international conflict. Right? So the money's right there. Number seven, profit margin magic, turning a dollar into 100,000. Many of you with printers, computer printers, will understand this. Which costs the consumer more, printer ink or bottled water? Calculations by Data Genetics reveals that ink in a $17 cartridge comes to almost $3,400 per gallon. The cost of a gallon of cartridge ink would buy enough gasoline to run the average car for over 2 years. Water seems to cost less until the details are factored in. Companies buy public water at almost no cost. What they got to do is run the tap, treat it in ways that aren't even known, and sell it back to us at an exorbitant markup. Nestle, for example, pays about $2 for public water, then produces about 100,000 plastic bottles of water. Ain't that sweet? So the author says, consumer exploiting, tax avoiding, profit maximizing, responsibility shirking, winner take all capitalism. This is an economic system which Milton Friedman once believed, quote, distributes the fruits of its economic progress among all people. What do you think? 248-544-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, and here is Michael Michaels in Clarkston. Michael, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Good, doing good. What's up?
Well, you asked a caller, previous caller, about some facts and stuff about Obama, what makes him a socialist or communist. What about the socialized medicine that he's, his medical plan and all this?
What do you when you say socialized or socialism, what do you mean?
Well, the socialized medicine.
That would be a government, you know, that would mean a government paid plan that would be paid for by tax money, right? Actually, this is a big giveaway to the private insurance companies. I mean, I wish he had socialized medicine like in Canada or England or France or Italy. But it really is this plan that enriches who in many ways it has caused the misery in our health system, the big insurance companies. So.
Yeah.
But okay, I'll give you that. What else? He's got one.
Well, every Canadian I've talked to, you know, they don't like their medical at all. And that's
weird. Every Canadian I talk to loves it. And every Canadian that calls this show loves it. Well, one thing, too, you got to remember, any bureaucratic system doesn't work completely as it's supposed to. And it always winds up screwing somebody or frustrating somebody. But I can't imagine anything worse than what we have here, where millions and millions and millions of people have no insurance. You know, there was a thing on television last night, Sunday night, that showed this car dealership in Jackson, Michigan, where all of the health plans that the company had given their employees were declared by the Affordable Health Care to be inadequate and had to be canceled. And these guys were going, whoa, what the hell? What's going on? Well, now we have no health plan. What that means was their health coverage was so bad that it didn't even meet the minimum standards. Not even, you know, they have this bronze, silver, and gold. It didn't even meet the bronze standard. That it cost thousands of dollars out of pocket, that it had huge copays and what have you. So, do you think people have to wait here for medical care? No, but I mean, the Canadians pretty much love their health care system.
All right. What about 90% of the people that have not read the full Obamacare plan? Why would there be martial law in a medical plan?
Well, first off, I would bet that it'd be like 99.9% have not read it, since it's hundreds and hundreds of pages.
They haven't read fully through, you're right.
And, Michael, if you do one of two things, and if that would be, you would either send me the notation or some information about where there is martial law in the healthcare law, or even one thing that we never, ever allow, but would do it with this because I'm asking you to be part of the Night Call research team. Call back with that. Will you do that?
Okay, yeah.
All right, so either call back tonight after you've found some citation or some news story or something like that, or email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's go. Hey, Maurice, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Hello, Peter and Jolene. How are you doing tonight?
Jolene is not here. She'll be disappointed she missed your call.
Okay. No, I still do not understand the Obamacare.
I don't think many people do.
You know what? It just came to me the other day. It was written by lawyers. That's why we don't understand it.
Maybe I don't know if I can help you. I'm looking at something called Obamacare Explained. Now you, if I'm right, you drive cab?
I stopped doing that.
Oh, okay. All right.
Too dangerous.
Wow. Well, are you working?
Yeah, I got a little job doing something.
Well, if it's a little job, you probably are eligible for the health plans under Obamacare, and you will get a subsidy from the government.
That I understand, but it's got so many different plans out there. It's kind of hard to find out which one that I want to go with.
I have no way to help you with that. You know, the only thing I wonder, you know, there's some places, maybe someone could tell us about this. There's some places where you can go in and apply in person and probably get some help. I'm pretty clueless about it, other than what I read in the paper, and I'd have no idea how to, you know, suggest you make a choice. I mean, other than it has good coverage.
Yeah, I'm going to look at it again and see. I'm going to go online again and read it again and see if it makes any sense.
Okay. Well, good luck. Hey, Maurice, Happy New Year to you. Okay. I haven't been wishing people that. I'm everybody who's called already, Happy New Year. All right. So mobile lines for you, 248-544-WRI. What is that? Jalene always says 248-544-9743, I think. Yeah, 9743. Give me your opinion. Obama, a couple of callers have said, well, what, that his father wasn't the Kenyan, but it was this African-American radical guy named Marshall, I believe. I mean, and this is, you know, on the low on the food chain of the right wing. This is another thing to prove. What? I mean, let's say it was. So what would that prove? Yeah. A lot of times, people aren't, you know, back in the day, people were probably a lot more radical, and then the sons turn out to be, and the daughters turn out to not be quite as radical. So if Obama's father was someone other than who every sensible person thinks was his father, and it was actually this either communist or communist, someone friendly to the communist movement in this country, what would that say about Obama? I mean, is it the sins of the father are passed down genetically? But if, see, it gives credence to this nonsense that he is like this Manchurian candidate, that he's going to put into place all of these communist socialist stuff like, well, he's still got a few years left. Let's go to Fred in Detroit. Fred, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning to you, Fred.
I'm a Marine, and you should listen to me.
I won't even go back and explain to people what that refers to. A caller a little while ago. Okay, I'm listening.
Yeah, old Drunk Ben, I think was his name.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, well, I'm just calling to say that it's a wonder that whites ever took over this world. With what I hear from some of your conservative callers whining about the federal government, whining about Obama, and like you just said, there's a lot that really does not matter, and you keep trying to give these people, not just conjecture, but you're telling them what's going on, and they did not, the last caller didn't even listen to how, you know, the free market and conservatives at the top of the capitalist world are just, you know, bleeding us dry and taking every advantage.
I don't know if you're...
He didn't want to hear that.
Are you... Well, I if you're talking about Kevin from Wayne, I thought he listened. Some of the other ones. But, you know, I got to tell you, when I'm talking, I mean, I'm talking directly to the caller who obviously is on the line. But in many ways, I mean, the people that think that Barack Obama is a Muslim who had a communist father and is trying to bring in the New World Order, they're not going to be impressed with a single thing I say. But, you know, people have heard little bits of that. And they go, you know, I mean, and they hear somebody at work saying, yeah, you know, he's a secret Muslim. It's been proved. And they go, oh, wow, the guy's Muslim? I didn't know that. It affects their consciousness about the world without them even appropriating it as consciously as a fact. So I want to, you know, kind of refute those things for the majority of people, not for somebody whose mind I probably wouldn't be able to change, you know, even if I tried, which I guess I am trying.
I mean, but still, you lay out so much information. You know, facts, figures, they tell you policy, you know, what is actually going on. It's not the good old Fox News, you know, what is it, shuffle, a 2-foot shuffle, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, where they spin and they scare the hell out of you and you get up and you run to the polls and you vote for the first idiot you can, you know. Like the Daryl Ices of the world, or the guy that looks like McCarthy down there in Texas. I can't think of his name.
Yeah, right. Ted Cruz. Looks like Senator McCarthy from the 50s, yeah.
And would have put the girl from Alaska in there if they had a chance.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate your call. You have a happy new year, too. I should have been wishing people that all along. Well, I did look up this thing that Ron was talking about, this Frank Marshall Davis, who, there's these right-wing sites that say that makes the case that Barack Obama's real father was this Frank Marshall Davis. But, and was he, according to this, he lived from 1905 to 1987. He's an American journalist, poet, political and labor movement activist, and businessman. He began his career as a writer. I'm trying to see if I can get through this real quickly. In he lived in, let's see. I'm trying to see whether they actually say he was a communist. Because you got to remember, I mean, if people say that Barack Obama is a communist, and some people have said that I'm a communist, what does that mean? Well, to me, a communist is someone who belonged to the Communist Party. Or they could say, I believe in communism. Well, let me do this. I see. He worked for what were, and a lot of people did this in the 30s and 40s, were close to what they called communist front organizations, that the communists were behind them. Now, the communists were, the parties were always a pretty despicable group, although they had good people in it. And it brought people into it that believed way back before anything really happened, civil rights, peace, civil liberties, and people would join these groups. People like Coleman Young, for instance, although probably with a lot of you, that's not a good example. But, for instance, he belonged, I think it was called the Negro Labor League, or something close to that, which supported labor rights. And because the Communist Party and other smaller socialist parties were the only groups in American society that in the 30s and into the 40s that advocated racial justice, the end to segregation. It was the Communist Party newspaper, the Daily Worker, that put in it every defense of Stalin, and the party line would change. Yet on the back page of their sports page, they were calling for the integration of Major League Baseball way before Jackie Robinson actually broke the color barrier. So it's a mixed bag. I'd say there's little about the Communist Party that I would find admirable, and certainly their fealty to this vicious police state was the least admirable of all of their activities. But there were a lot of people that found themselves enmeshed in the so-called front organization. All right, let's take a break. I'll be right back. Jalene's gone home. She's got to do some rock and roll tomorrow on one of our sister stations here. And I'll get your calls at 248-544-WRIF.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call. Night call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. I actually turned on Jalene's mic, even though she's not here. Went home an hour early. She got to do some rock and roll on one of our sister stations. You can call us, 248. Same say us. You can call me, Peter Werby, at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. At 1 a.m., coming up in just about 24 minutes, James P. Steyer speaking about Facebook, even though I saw a 13-year-old on the news saying, it's history. We don't do that anymore. And also, Martin Lee, Smoke Signals, a social history of marijuana, medical, recreational, and scientific. This is all I'm reading from my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. You can email us and me and us, this time Jalene, at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'm sorry. That's right. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I'm thinking about 16 things now. She usually thinks about half of them. Most of the stuff that's on my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, is also on our Night Call Facebook page. You can just go to facebook.com/nightcall. Let's see. Go back and get another caller here. This is Paul. Paul is in Livonia. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Peter. Yeah, what frustrates me so much is these, you have like a large population of conservatives that like are basically 65 to 85 years old. So they wouldn't even be insurable if it wasn't for socialism, socialized medicine, Medicare.
Sure. That's the only real socialized medicine. Well, we have other aspects of socialized medicine, which is also the veterans insurance as well.
Well, yeah, that the VA too, but Medicare is 8%, but these 65 to 85 year old conservatives don't get 8% Medicare, and whatever supplement they get is 20% because Medicare only carries 80%. It could come harm them, but you know the government has never allowed it.
Right.
And what happens too, and that's what gets me so frustrated with these people. And they wouldn't even have these 65-year-olds in this country, this large population. They're going to die out soon. I don't want anybody to die, but they're going to die out soon. And they don't even realize it's socialism that saved them and unions. They don't even understand the Gilded Age. You know.
Well, you know, Paul, what I always say, there's a lot of socialism around here. It's called schools. It's called police. It's called fire. It's called... health department, all of that. The cost is socialized. That's what it means here. In the 19th century, when capitalism was so awful, and actually it is the same way around most of the world these days, Bangladesh, places like that, that people called for the absolute overthrow of capitalism and its replacement by a socialist republic. And that would mean that all forms of private property, the big companies, the big corporations, would be gotten rid of. But what really is being talked about here is what they call, and I'm sure you know, the social democracy, like they have in Sweden, like they have in Finland, where the government socializes a lot of the social cost so that burden is distributed equally and doesn't hurt people so badly like happens here in the richest country in the world.
But there's something more to this, too, and it's coming out with... learning of the human brain, that your politics, self-centeredness is a form of mental immaturity and a form of sociopathism. From the lower level to like Hitler, the higher level, and your politics are, this is becoming a real deal now, you know, and it's your politics are, your thinking is really where you are as far as your mental maturity goes, and it all plays in.
Well, sure. People actually in authoritarian societies, that's why I say there's a third of the population that would accept fascism. They would have accepted fascism during the Bush administration, during the Clinton administration, you know, even when the economy was going good under Clinton, or you know, when one of their boys was in office during the Bush administration. And so it's interesting if I'm right, it's kind of scary. Let's say there's a third of the population is fascist. So to get a majority, what do they got to get? 14% more of the people.
And they'll follow sociopathic con artists over the cliff.
Yeah, absolutely, like they did in Europe. But maybe I'm wrong, because the most votes that Hitler ever got, people say, you know, the German people, they're so authoritarian. The most votes that Hitler's party ever got was like, I don't even think it was a third. I think it was like 30%. And actually, if the communists and the socialists and the liberals would have banded together, they would have had Hitler never would have come to power.
But you know, Peter, I think more people are not that way. That's why I think we're still, you know, it's just, yeah, I agree with you on that score, yeah. But
yeah.
But it's becoming, yeah, a psychological thing with people that are really just like, it's a form of retardation, and it can't help it. It's really coming out.
I'll tell you, the first political book I ever read was called The Mass Psychology of Fascism. And most people on the left look through the lens of the economy, which is important to do, and I do. I do that as well. But what really influenced me was this book by a man named Wilhelm Reich, like Third Reich, except he was a lefty. And it was called The Mass Psychology of Fascism. I think it's still worth looking at, today. All right, well, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks for joining in. Here is Carol. Carol is in Ipsy. Carol, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter, how you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question also.
Sure.
The one comment I was going to make, you know, you hear all these communist and socialist and all these labels. And what's really funny about it, and you probably heard this before yourself, I remember back in the day, back in the 60s, because I was against the war, I was called a commie pinko. And I'm not a communist, and, you know, I knew communists in my life, but you know what I mean? They were quick to label me just because I was against the war, and I don't know. I thought that was kind of weird.
that means they didn't have to answer any of your objections to this.
That's
absolutely.
Right. And they, most of the time they couldn't.
Right. Well, because it was another war based on lies, based on a fabricated incident that initiated the Vietnam War. So, and it's interesting. Because, you know, this commie pinko, that I love the phrase, but, you know, pinko comes from, people would call communist reds because that's the color of the revolutionary flag, an all red flag.
Yeah.
And then someone would say, well, you know, maybe he's not red, but he's pink. And again, that would mean that, these were people that supported civil liberties and civil rights and labor rights, and you know, I'm talking about 30s and 40s and 50s.
Right.
So the people would say, well, he's a pinko. And what a weird thing to be called.
I know. But, you know, actually, I took it as a compliment.
Absolutely.
And one more question,
sure.
Real quick. I wanted to know, what was the name of the book that you were reading out of earlier about capitalism?
The Seven Things That Capitalism Didn't Want You to Know?
Yes.
That's on my website. You can just go... Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E,
.com.
Yeah, it's there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, and you have a good new year.
You too, Carol. Thanks for joining me. Appreciate it. All right. Molly, where's the button here? Yeah, that's what Jolene does for me. Here's something. This is not exactly controversial. I don't think conservatives and liberals or lefties have any difference of opinion. Here's a friend of mine, and I've interviewed him a couple of times on this broadcast and even rebroadcast it because it has such an effect on me. It's a doctor, a medical doctor, Dr. Howard Schubiner. He works here in the Detroit area. And he and other doctors around, a number of doctors around the country, subscribe to this idea in its simpler definition. There's actually a big fancy medical name for it. The mind-body origin of a lot of our ailments. That is to say, some of you know this, I've mentioned this before. He used to have a website called Your Pain is Real. And the reason that he did this was because he began initially becoming interested in the theories of a Dr. Robert Sarno, S-A-R-N-O. And Dr. Sarno is an orthopedic surgeon in New York. I think he's like about 90 and still practicing. And he postulated that the vast majority of back and neck aches, isn't there another thing that people, back, neck, and stuff like that, is generated in our psyche, not in some injury or stenosis or crushed discs or anything like that. And you go, well, wait a minute. And some of you are saying, I got an MRI. I got an X-ray, and they show stenosis where the spinal cord is rubbing on, you know, whatever it goes through in the spine, or that disc number so-and-so is crushed. Well, one of the things that Dr. Sarno did, is he began doing MRIs in the backs of people that weren't complaining about backaches. And guess what? Had the same kind of conditions. And the reason he said that, it's not like this stuff wouldn't cause pain, but sometimes where people was experiencing pain didn't have anything to do with where the crushed disc was. And people would get mad at Dr. Schubiner because they would say, you're trying to tell me I'm imagining this pain, that I can't sleep, that I've been to chiropractors and I've had massages and I take medicine and I'm on ibuprofen, 800 milligrams a day. And you're telling me I'm imagining this? And he said, no, I'm not telling you you're imagining it at all. But I have a treatment and I have a method that can deal with this. My own wife, where we went to him, she had bad sciatica. This is where you get this horrible pain down your leg. And one of the things that Dr. Schubiner sets him off on, looking at the mind-body connection for ailments, if there's not a clear physical root to it, In other words, people say, well, why? I threw my back out. How'd you do it? I sneezed. Wow, that's weird. How did that happen? Oh, I know. Here's a good one. What's it called? Whiplash. There's soft tissue damage, and 5 years later, people are still experiencing pain. And Dr. Shubin and Dr. Sarno say, that's impossible. There's no way that you could be still injured. But what you're getting are these, I'm forgetting all this, the memory in the, what is it? But anyway, there's these memory paths and patterns that are retained because it is a way of diverting strong emotions out of your brain and into your body. I mean, so it's pure psychological stuff, yet the pain is no less intense and severe and crippling in some cases than it is if you, in fact, had those injuries to your spine or your neck or whatever. Because some people do. Because if you go to Dr. Schubiner with your x-rays, he'll look at it and go, whoa, I can't do anything about this. You've got to go down to the orthopedic guy because you do, in fact, have some problem. And one of the things, I thought everybody I knew would jump to this, because you know, a lot of the sports I do, guys are always getting injured. I always say, I'm going to have a neck injury, or I have a neck operation to fuse these things together. I say, well, why don't you go see Dr. Schubiner first? You know, most of it will be covered by insurance, not all of it, but it's pretty minimal. And the worst thing that he can do with his method is nothing. Pardon me. That nothing will happen to you. In other words, you'll be right where you started, and at least you'll have had some information about yourself, because you kind of do some, like, self-work. And I'm not really big. It's just 1 second. There we go. This kind of self-help books and all that. But, having taken it, the class with my wife, I still use some of the things every day that deal with strong emotions that come up. Anger, anxiety, stuff like that. And just, you kind of learn how to dissipate all of that, which is pretty good. Pretty good information to have. Now, what else is there? This just came out. This is in the New York Times on Sunday. A popular surgical procedure worked no better than fake operations in helping people with one type of common knee problem, suggesting that thousands of people may be undergoing unnecessary surgery. And this is from the New England Journal of Medicine. The unusual study involved people with torn meniscus. That's with this little cartilage in your knee that helps cushion your knee and stabilize it and all that. Arthroscopic surgery on the meniscus is the most common orthopedic procedure in the United States. It's practiced 700,000 times a year. Pardon me, and the estimated cost is $4 billion. This study was conducted in Finland, involved a small subset of meniscal tears. Yeah. But experts, including some orthopedic surgeons, said that the study added to other recent research studying the meniscal surgery should be aimed at a narrower group of parents. Boy, it's getting late, is it? Patients. That for many, options like physical therapy may be just as good. Now, they're not saying that it never helps, that it should be performed in some circumstances, particularly on younger patients and for tears from acute sport industries, but that 80% of tears develop from wear and aging, and some researchers believe surgery in those cases should be significantly limited. The volunteer patients in the Finnish study all received anesthesia and incisions, but, it's arthroscopic, so it's very little. And then they were sewed up, half of them, and they didn't know, and I think they knew this was going on. But some received actual surgery, others simulated procedure, and they did not know which. A year later, most patients in both groups said their knees felt better, and the vast majority said they would choose the same method again, even if it was a fake. This is great, isn't it? And this is not the first time this has come about. An old friend of mine who's head of placebo research at the Harvard Medical School, placebo, fake pills, and that when they're doing it, I mean, they want to give you, what are those called, blind, some other studies, they got to have a control group. So half the people get, like, the medicine, the other half don't, and then they study what happens. So in this study, going back even a few years, same thing with the knee surgery. I mean, you don't want to do like back surgery, cut open somebody's back. But so what does this all tell you? You can go to that website, although it's not called that. This is, what is it, Living Without Pain, something like that. But if you go to Dr. Schubiner's website, which is yourpainisreal.com. It's quite extraordinary. And for one thing, you know, when people say, I don't believe it. Well, we believe it about a lot of stuff, don't we? We believe that if you're under a lot of stress, if you're really angry, your stomach will get upset. If you're in a big argument with your parents or with your children or what have you, you'll get a headache. We all believe that. We believe there's a direct connection. It, literally, it's the same thing. You know, in many ways, like if you're angry, that rage expresses itself physically. So why couldn't it do it in your back as well? Why couldn't it do it in your neck as well? It's worth looking at. I mean, if we're talking now about hundreds of thousands of surgeries just in your knee and maybe something that won't work, that little bit ends the show. I want to thank all of you for being part of it, for listening, for calling, for agreeing with me, even for disagreeing with me. Everybody likes to be agreed with. But, you know, the people that disagree with me, you keep me sharp. You make me look up stuff. I appreciate that as well. Jefferson, thank you so much for being part of the show and doing all the work all by yourself in the other room answering the phones. And, hey, talk to you in the new year. But stay tuned for a couple of very interesting interviews.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call.
When intelligence matters, the Verizon exclusive Droid Ultra by Motorola has voice-activated touchless control that understands over 140 commands. When it matters, Droid does. Only from Verizon. Click the banner to learn more.
Hi, I'm Joe Theismann. No matter what stadium I broadcast from, I'd always have to find the closest bathroom, just in case I had that sudden urge to go. My prostate was giving me fits, but then I heard about Super Beta Prostate's nationwide million-bottle giveaway, and I got a free bottle. What a difference it made. I don't have to go as often, and I don't have to get up at night as much. Now I wake up refreshed and ready to tackle anything. What's so special about Super Beta Prostate is that it's the most widely used supplement supporting a healthy prostate. Super Beta Prostate has sold over 5 million bottles, and it also has a trusted 10-year history, and it's all natural. There's no reason to accept the issues that come with an aging prostate. So get Super Beta Prostate today.
Call right now and you'll learn how to get a free bottle of Super Beta Prostate. Pay only shipping and handling. Call 1-800-459-7640. That's 1-800-459-7640. Hurry, supplies are limited. Call 1-800-459-7640. That's 1-800-459-7640.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, you're on!
The Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. If you've heard some of these broadcasts that we do when we're talking about drug prohibition, I often quote this bumper sticker I saw one time. It said, "War on drugs? I can't even drive on drugs." But the prohibition of all intoxicants, except for the ones that we're allowed to imbibe, like alcohol and cigarettes, has been going on a long, long time now. The human wreckage in terms of arrests is just, you know, up in the tens of millions. Probably a good $1 trillion have been spent trying to stop people from, well, in terms of marijuana, what John Sinclair, Detroit's John Sinclair, said one time, to stop people from smoking flowers. But this is you know, something that's embedded in these culture wars that are going on. And it's good to know what's happening. And a man that has done such great research about this is Martin A. Lee. And he's been on the broadcast before, and he reminds me that it was quite a while ago that I interviewed him about his book, Acid Dreams. But also The Beast Reawakens was not so long ago, another one of his books. And Martin Lee is the co-founder and director of Project CBD, an educational service that reports on developments in cannabis science and therapeutics. The book is called Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. And appropriately, we're reaching him at his home in Sonoma County in Northern California. Martin Lee, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Pleasure to be with you.
And so this book, you know, we hear now the contest for medical marijuana has taken just I mean, so many different directions. I mean, we people are just able to buy it at some places here in Michigan and out there in California, and then the feds come in and raid them. What's going on?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, the whole situation. There's a lot of contradictions in both federal, state, and local policies with respect to marijuana or cannabis, as many scientists and medical patients prefer to call it. But I think the contradictions are rooted in the fact that you have a plant that, for all intents and purposes, is really relatively benign. It's never killed anybody. You can't overdose from it. People sometimes can take marijuana and have uncomfortable experiences. But for the most part, it's not very harmful. In fact, what scientists have found from extensive research is that there are a lot of health benefits from it. But the prohibition of marijuana, which dates back in the United States to 1937 when it was banned, really is rooted in the fact that at the time, during the Depression in the United States, this was the Depression years, remember, there was a lot of budget cutting within the government. There was tightening to get out of debt and so forth. And the entire Federal Bureau of Narcotics was on the chopping block. It was about to be eliminated. And the head of that agency, Harry Anslinger, decided he had to do something to basically save his bureaucratic kingdom, keep it from being his whole group from being fired. And he came up with the Reefer Madness campaign.
Let me just interrupt to say, I mean, up till then they were mostly concerned with drugs like heroin that had been made illegal, like in the late teens of that century, right?
Yes, and it's interesting because when you look at the reports from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in the mid-1930s, a couple of years before it was made illegal, basically said there wasn't much of an issue here, that they didn't see it as a plant that posed much of a
marijuana,
danger at all. Yes. So what they did was create a whole myth around marijuana, that you smoke one joint, you go out and kill your uncle, your brother, this kind of thing. This is all the hoary myths associated with reefer madness that we look back on now and we can kind of chuckle and laugh at. Was instilled in the American public. A lot of it was driven by racism, the suggestion that if a black person smoked marijuana, he'd be more likely to go out and rape a white woman. This were explicitly stated by Anslinger, these sorts of things. And it was really to make sure that his Federal Bureau of Narcotics stayed funded and stayed in existence, in fact, would expand their budget at a time when there wasn't a lot of money around in the government. And he succeeded. Mm-hmm. It's really quite incredible. And a lot of these myths have stuck with people today, even though we don't believe some of the ludicrous caricatures anymore. Still, these myths tend to be recycled in softer forms, and they're still with us, and certainly the legacy of marijuana prohibition is still with us.
Yeah, and also very anti-Mexican as well. I mean, it was that there was always these stories about Mexicans would and African-Americans would smoke marijuana, and then they would try to be arrested. It would take 20 cops to pin them down because they went so crazy. You can still see, I think you can even see the whole film online, Reefer Madness, which is quite a piece of work. Now, Harry Anslinger, the head of the Federal Narcotics Agency, he was like a crazy version of J. Edgar Hoover, who was totally mad, you know, himself, right?
You know, interestingly, yes, they were almost caricatures of each other, and yet they were bureaucratic rivals. Anslinger from the Narcotics Bureau kept insisting that organized crime, the mafia, was heavily involved in the marijuana trade, which was not actually true. And J. Edgar Hoover from the FBI seemed to be committed to the notion that the mafia didn't actually even exist in the United States. He had his own reasons for that. So they had their points of disagreement, but they did agree that marijuana was a terrible menace that threatened particularly American youth and American women. They would always play on those themes.
American white women.
Yes.
Martin A. Lee is my guest. The book is Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. You can go to smokesignalsthebook.com. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. I think the story, for those who haven't heard it, and I enjoyed rereading it in the Smoke Signals, how the incredible jazz scene of the 1930s played into Harry Anslinger's federal agency, conspiracy tell the story. I won't try to summarize it.
Well, in a nutshell, Anslinger wanted to make a big splash in the media, and he decided the best way to do that is if he can organize a coordinated marijuana bust of several high-profile jazz musicians around the country, do it all in one day at the same time. It would make for a big story, big news story, and again, it would justify funding his bureaucratic entity within the government. It never materialized because the narcotics agents weren't really able to penetrate the jazz scene. It's sort of a closed scene in its own way, and they couldn't do this. But Anslinger and also his main backer in the press, Hearst, the founder of Yellow Journalism, he really did it strong when it came to marijuana. Both Anslinger and Hearst were orchestrating this campaign, and it was very much driven by racism, as you mentioned, anti-black racism, anti-Mexican racism, and it was both Anslinger and Hearst had their own reasons for doing it. Racism was the vehicle, but the end result was instilling this prohibition on the books, which has stayed with us for a long time.
If my memory serves me, they had in their sights like the greats of American music, like Duke Ellington and Count Basie, and why can't I think of the man's name who sang, I'm a viper. What was Mesmero was another. Yeah.
Yeah. You're talking about Fats Waller there.
Yeah, Fats Waller. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. So as you said, Martin Lee, we laugh at these people. I've seen little magnets, refrigerator magnets. Say reefer madness, but the reefer madness, rather than just sort of laughing at these straight-laced, essentially yokels like Harry Anslinger and J. Edgar Hoover, immense damage has been done to Americans and America. Maybe talk about that and bring us up to speed, and we'll get to more of the medical, recreational, and scientific parts of your Smoke Signals book. But is there a way to really estimate how much we've spent, how many people have been put in jail for, as John Sinclair said, smoking flowers?
Well, in terms of the overall drug war, and we have to keep in mind that marijuana is the linchpin of the drug war. That's where most of the arrests are made. That's where most of the money is spent in terms of controlling marijuana, and yet it proliferates uncontrolled in our society, the use of marijuana. We're talking nearly $1 trillion spent since this drug war was launched by Harry Anslinger back in the late 1930s. We're talking about 20 million arrests, and even in the same themes keep perpetuating. We don't think of reefer madness, and you smoke a joint and you go crazy like they showed in the film, and people look at it and people laugh. And yet still today, federal government, federal agencies, federal spokesmen are claiming that young people are at risk of smoking marijuana and becoming schizophrenic. Again, it's bogus, the idea that marijuana smoking leads to schizophrenia. If that was the case, we'd see a tremendous rise in the incidence of schizophrenia in the United States since the 1960s. It's never happened. The rates of schizophrenia have stayed very constant in our culture, in our society, and around the world. It's about 1%. And if it actually caused schizophrenia, marijuana, you'd see vastly higher schizophrenia rates. So these bogus themes keep getting recycled and retread.
Yes, but they do, but I think it's almost accepted as a part of American culture. That is, that how many what percentage of teenagers drink before the legal age? I know I did. I mean, I don't want to get any public confession from you unless you're willing to, but probably great number. Well, I don't get one. Great numbers of people listening drank before the legal age, and they knew they were at risk from getting kicked out of school to getting in trouble with the law and all of that. So this is just they assume this is part of the fabric. This is something that we have to do surreptitiously.
And also the contradictions are part of the fabric. Today the federal government gives out marijuana to a handful of medical patients who have such serious illnesses that they're considered medical necessity patients. Without marijuana, they would die. There were four such individuals left. They used to give out to more than that, but the program has been terminated. So on the one hand, the federal government is giving out 30 pre-rolled joints of marijuana each month to four individuals in the United States, while at the same time claiming that marijuana has no medical value. That's an example of one of many of the contradictions in the policy. And the basic contradiction is here we have a substance that is not lethal, that is not toxic. We're talking about marijuana. That may make a person feel uncomfortable. It may make them feel unpleasant if they take it, but it's not going to harm in a physiological sense the way alcohol does, which is a poison. And yet alcohol is not only legal, it's encouraged in our society. Marijuana is illegal. The contradictions are there. The contradictions are everywhere when it comes to marijuana policy in the United States.
Now, you got to assume that the President of the United States has smoked marijuana, given some of his other admissions about drug use. And one would suspect that that Paul Ryan, the candidate for the vice presidency, given his age, probably has maybe even the mitten, right? He was very, they say mitt happens, right?
Use a little, maybe. I don't know. Just kidding, of course.
I wonder if you started going through the Congress and through the state houses. I mean, I got to believe it, that the usage is up around 50%, probably higher among Democrats. But there is not the slightest movement, the political movement, towards having a sensible drug policy.
And it is curious, given that one of the arguments made by legalization advocates, those who feel that marijuana should not be illegal, they point to the economic factors here that you have in states where medical marijuana is legal and where there, I know in Michigan there was, it's been a crackdown and the whole scene is contracted. It's been happening right elsewhere as well. But you had a tremendous robust economic activity. So many jobs were being created. In California alone, it's over a $1 billion industry, just the medical side of the marijuana equation. So it's really kind of strange, you would think, that the federal government would be so insistent on basically taking this whole scene down if they're successful. That's basically what they're trying to do in California. They have 1,400 medical marijuana dispensaries where a person can go in if they have a note from a doctor certifying they have a condition that could be helped by marijuana, and marijuana does help many medical conditions. They can go into a store in California or some of the other states and buy their marijuana to use medicinally. Well, the federal government is intent on destroying this. Of the 1,400 dispensaries in California, only about half of them still exist, and there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the scene. And it doesn't really make much sense. I don't understand quite what the Obama administration is doing, given the fact that the president has admitted that he used to smoke a lot of pot as a kid.
No,
so,
it didn't
seem to harm him that much. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, it is quite clear within jurisprudence that federal law preempts any state law. In other words, the state of Michigan could not say, okay, we're going to have slavery, or I can't think of, or something like that, right? So there is some legal basis, and I'm somebody who supports complete legalization or the decriminalization of all drug use, and all drugs, let's say, including the awful ones. I mean, this is individuals have to deal with that on a medical and psychological basis, not for the government to control it with men with guns. It's absurd. I'm coming from a completely libertarian, the only point I'd probably be coming from a libertarian point of view on with drugs. Yet, legally, federal law preempts state law. So I'm surprised there's not more of a crackdown.
Well, there is also the understanding that states work to be considered laboratories of democracy, where they can experiment in certain areas. And the laws in states where they've approved medical marijuana don't directly conflict with federal law. In California, basically all that they've said is, okay, federal law exists, but state law, which also bans marijuana, you can have an exception. If you get a card from a doctor or a letter from a doctor saying you have an ailment that could be helped by cannabis, marijuana, then you're exempt from state law. It doesn't say anything about federal law. So it's a gray area. There is a lot of conflict here. And the great tragedy is important medical advances are being slowed down, nipped in the bud. I mean, there's, if I might mention one thing that I discovered while writing Smoke Signals, is that there turns out that there is a compound in marijuana called cannabidiol. It only exists in the marijuana plant. The initials for it are known as CBD, cannabidiol. It's non-psychoactive. It doesn't make people feel stoned or high. It has no effect that way. And yet it has tremendous medical benefits. Scientists have found that that CBD protects the brain against alcohol poisoning. It actually can promote the growth of new brain cells in the human brain. It can stop the onset of diabetes. It mitigates the formation of Alzheimer's plaque, all these tremendous things, and the government has been squandering this precious substance because it's part of the marijuana plant, so it's illegal, even though it has no known side effects whatsoever. So this is the great tragedy, that some very useful things could be happening, but the government is stopping, is slowing down what I think is eventually has to happen. The plant has to be legalized, or I should say re-legalized, because there's a majority of people in the country now that favor this, and certainly an overwhelming majority favor that people should have the option, if they should so choose, to use the plant for medicinal purposes. And the story and the discovery of cannabidiol, CBD, this compound that doesn't get you stoned, that has such tremendous medical benefits, really underscores the importance of moving in that direction.
And my guest on the Peter Wirby Show is Martin Lee. He's also the co-founder and director of Project CBD. Now, is CBD an extraction that, or does one get it by smoking, or both?
It exists in the marijuana plant. It's an interesting story there. So what happened is, it used to be in the old days that CBD was in the plant as much as THC, which is the compound that does get people high and stoned, tetrahydrocannabinol. CBD and THC were in the plant together. But when in the United States, back in the late 70s, early 1980s, when some American farmers started to try to breed their own strains, make particular strains of the cannabis plant that they could sell, that people would enjoy using, they purposely bred it in such a way to make people feel more high, to make people feel more stoned, because they assumed that's what people wanted,
sure,
recreational users. And as a result, the CBD component in the plant got sort of bred out of existence largely, because CBD, interestingly, counters the psychoactivity of THC. It neutralizes it.
Huh.
So if you have a lot of CBD in a particular strain, you won't feel stoned, which for people who don't like marijuana means there's tremendous therapeutic opportunities there. So what happened is we ended up in a situation where almost all the marijuana one could get on the street, so to speak, the black market marijuana or even the gray market marijuana in the dispensaries that are selling medical marijuana, almost all of it was the high THC kind that got you very high. Very few strains actually had CBD, but these were rediscovered in California a couple of years ago, where they had labs starting to test what was actually in the plant, what cannabinoids, as they're called. There's over 100 of them in the plant. CBD and THC are the most prominent ones, but many of these have the cannabinoids, so-called, have medicinal properties. Well, when these were rediscovered, my partner Fred Gardner and I, we formed an information service, Project CBD, to tell people about CBD and all its medical benefits. And one of the things we learned about was that CBD shrinks cancerous tumors. There's been experiments with brain cancer and breast cancer that the scientists found. This is a scientist at the Pacific Medical Center in California. In San Francisco, they found that when you administer CBD into a cell line, a brain cancer cell line that's been kept alive after a person has died, that it smashes it in a test tube, and they then gave it to rats and found it did the same thing. And there's even been some human experiments with THC and brain cancer. They found ultimately that CBD and THC both can shrink tumors, cancerous tumors, and that they work best when they're both used together at the same time, that they enhance each other's effects. This is fascinating, and if we had a government committed not so much to a foolish prohibition, but to really exploring the medical potential of this plant, we'd be in a much better shape today.
Now, is CBD, is that available? I mean, is there an extract that people have, you know, would have access to, or is
there? There are extracts in California and some of the other states, and they have different ratios. So you can order an extract that will have almost all CBD and very little THC. You won't find one that's just CBD, because,
okay,
then again, in the plant, it's never just one compound that tells the story here. You generally, what you find in dispensaries, you can get plants with a lot of THC and very little CBD. But now the extracts, things you can put a few drops in a drink, measured doses that are calibrated along specific ratios, so you can order a extract that has 2-to-1 CBD related to THC, or 3-to-1, or 10-to-1, or 1-to-1, whatever seems to work best for one's condition. And they're finding, the doctors who are recommending this, to have really amazing results for a broad range of conditions, including people involved in trying to get off a drug addiction, alcohol addiction, that administering CBD can help them quite a bit.
If you'd like more information on this, and there's just an immense amount of other information about marijuana, the book is Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. My guest is the author, Martin Lee. It's published by Scribner, and the book is the website is smokesignalsthebook.com. We just have a few minutes left, and in many ways I would have liked to have ended on that very positive note, but you know, we're talking about medical usage, and I think most people understand that and know that and support that, and that's one of the reasons why you said the majority of people support medical marijuana. On the other hand, I'm sure you realize that I could find a doctor, I'm completely healthy, I have no ailments whatsoever, and in about 20 minutes for about $175, I could get a doctor's note saying, oh yeah, he's got nonspecific back pain or something like that, and I could be at a marijuana dispensary and buying marijuana for which I would only be using it recreationally. And that's one of the complaints that the authorities have about the medical marijuana.
I think there's a reality to that. That does happen. I think that the system is, you know, stretched and used for purposes other than, strictly speaking, with a medical intent. However, you know, I think a lot of people end up using marijuana for the same reason that other people might use an antidepressant drug or an anti-anxiety drug or something to make them sleep easier. You know, all those things marijuana can actually do for a person as well, and there's science to show how it works.
Have fun, to go to a rock concert or even a classical music performance.
I think the line between recreational and therapeutic use is kind of blurry at points, and what we, you know, the argument that tends to get the criticism that made is, well, people are using marijuana, but they're not for really serious ailments. Well, a lot of people use pharmaceuticals for not that serious of an ailment. Not being able to sleep, well, actually, over time, that is serious. But if people use a sleeping pill and helps them get to sleep, and another person uses marijuana and helps them to get to sleep or sleep better, well, what's the real difference there? Are we to say, well, the marijuana user, he shouldn't be able, or she shouldn't be able to do it because it's not a serious ailment? Well, people use pharmaceuticals and drugs for many different things. The point is, we should encourage situations where people use these things wisely and don't harm themselves. And I think marijuana is something that can be used very, very safely overall, mm-hmm. for the most part. And people, and I think that if people were more educated about what it could do, it would be helpful. But unfortunately, prohibition of marijuana doesn't encourage an educated population.
Yeah. I was going to say, and ultimately it's no business of the government, but I would amend that to say there's many helpful ways that people, that the government rather, could deal with people's use of intoxicants, to be sure. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. The book is Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. The author is Martin Lee. You can go to smokesignalsthebook.com. It's published by Scribner. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. Thank you so much, Martin Lee, for being back on The Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Whether it's a serious fall, fire danger, or other type of home emergency, Life Alert is there for you. The company, with its slogan, "Help, I've fallen and I can't get up," protects its members. Here are some of them.
When you have a heart attack like I did and there's no one there, Life Alert was there for me.
Having a secure feeling through Life Alert is ideal.
My independence is possible because of it.
Now, Life Alert can also protect you in a fire emergency with a system that automatically notifies our monitoring center.
Thanks to Life Alert, you can live alone without ever being alone.
With Life Alert protection, elderly people can avoid or delay going into a nursing facility. For a free brochure about Life Alert service, call now, 1-800-404-2454. That's 1-800-404-2454. Call Life Alert now for your free brochure at 1-800-404-2454.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. And I think all of us are aware of how much crime exists in this society. A lot of the criminal rates are down for murder, for violent crimes, and what have you. But still, all of us understand that crime, criminality, behavior that makes our life, erodes the quality of our life goes on. When malefactors are caught, what's done with them? They're put in jail. And most of us say, that's good. The more of these guys you can get off the streets, the better. And the fact that the United States has the highest incarceration rate, both percentage in terms of G20 countries and also total numbers in the world, I don't think bothers most of us, because we say, hey, if there's that many people doing crime, let's put as many of them in jail as we can. In fact, maybe one of the problems is there's not enough of them in jail. Maybe we should have twice as many people in jail to end the kind of crime that makes all of us worried about where we travel, the security of our house, the security of our children, our spouses, and what have you. What if, though, there was the opposite was so? What if putting people in prison actually was part of the problem? Well, a book has come my way, extraordinarily challenging in terms of what most of us think. It's called A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. And epidemiology, you think, doesn't that have to do with plagues? And why is this a plague of prisons? Well, the book is written by Ernest Drucker. He's a scholar in residence and senior research associate at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's professor emeritus of family and social medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and an adjunct professor of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. And he's directed a drug addiction treatment and AIDS research program in the poorest neighborhoods of the South Bronx from 1970 to 1990. He's the editor-in-chief of the International Harm Reduction Journal and a Fulbright Senior Specialist in Global Health. He lives in New York City. We're reaching him at his office there, and I'll tell you in a second why I read such a long introduction for Ernest Drucker and all that he's accomplished. Welcome to the broadcast, Ernest Drucker.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, all of that, all of what I just read, it all fits in, doesn't it, to a plague of prisons. People generally would think you'd be a sociologist, but the fact that you're involved in family and social medicine, you've done epidemiology having to do with drug addiction and AIDS, that fits in. Tell us how this medical concept could possibly relate to prisons.
Well, it sort of comes out of my own experience, which you gave a very good synopsis of, because it seems like I've gone through a lot of different lines of work, but in fact they're all related in an important way. They're all part of public health, which is how I think of my profession now, although I started life as a psychologist or an engineer before that. So I was trained as a scientist, and I, working in mental health as a psychologist early on in the 60s, began to see the drug problem appear and opened the drug program in the Bronx, which grew into quite a large one, 1,000 patients in three clinics. We used a lot of heroin addicts. We treated them with methadone. And in the 1980s, that turned into an AIDS program, because during the 70s, AIDS had entered the population in New York City. It was transmitted by people sharing needles, sexual transmission as well. And by the time we had a test for HIV, half of our patients were infected with it. People had already died before we even knew what it was. And at the same time, in the 80s, which is really the opening gun of the war on drugs in earnest, everybody was getting arrested and going to jail, because my hospital also ran the jail health program at Rikers Island, the biggest prison in the world, 20,000 people at the time. And we did over 100,000 physical exams a year. We did treatment there. So we were seeing AIDS and tuberculosis and this kind of synergy of different epidemics, in the usual sense, infectious diseases. And it began to become apparent that the drug problems that these people faced, the AIDS problems, and the criminal justice problems, because they were getting arrested for doing what their illness was, which was being drug addicts, all went together in a way that not only was it very hard to separate them, there was no point in separating them. They were part of the same ecology. And those were policies which, instead of reacting to public health and mental health and addiction problems as health problems, treated them as criminal problems, primarily. That was the default position. Realized that we needed a model for that. And I began to work on this idea back then and of looking at the epidemiology of the incarceration part, because you're your introduction of the issue around people being concerned about their public safety, crime. Obviously, we've all been victims of crime, and many of us have been punished for crimes that we've committed ourselves, minor and major, in our lifetime. So this, that phenomenon is not alien to us, but it's very individual. And one of the big distinctions of public health from medicine is that medicine is highly individual. You know, it's your diagnosis, it's your treatment, it's your doctor, and you want it to be one case at a time. But public health is collective, it's the population, and quite a different level of analysis. You're concerned with how something spreads from person to person, how you can interfere in that process. And for the whole population, immunization being the classic example of how you protect populations. Prevention is the point of public health. And from that framework in which I was working and being paid with taxpayers' money, it became clear that our policies about drugs, for example, and drug addiction and drug treatment were being overwhelmed by the criminal justice approach and the war on drugs. And that needed to be understood as a negative public health policy and blamed for some of what was going on. And what was going on was this huge expansion of the prison population. And if, as you said, it was as simple as removing people from the street who do crimes so they can't do crimes anymore, so be it. But in fact, they're not really removed. They're temporarily taken away from their families and their community. That's the punishment, basically. And they put in these places where awful things happen to them frequently. And then they're sent back to those families and communities, the worse for wear. There's a book by the president of my college, Jeremy Travis, called But They All Come Home. And the but is very significant because people don't think about that side of it. In fact, they don't think about this kind of punishment in general. They think about, except as you said, thank God they're not out selling drugs to my kids in the street. They're not mugging me or stealing my car radio, the nuisance factor, or the danger, perfectly reasonable at the individual level, but exactly the wrong way to look at it as a population problem.
My guest is Ernest Drucker. He's written Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. I could imagine people listening and saying, is this going to be one of these guys that's soft on prisoners and he thinks we're coddling you? Remember, I haven't even heard that in a long time. They used to use that phrase, you probably remember, coddling criminals.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The politics of it revolve around that phenomenon. You know, you open your mouth. Have you heard the word drugs or drug crimes or prison in any campaign in this election year? I haven't.
No, not yet.
Remember when Dukakis ran against Bush Sr., it was like the number one problem in various polls. And Willie Horton, you know, who'd been put out of prison, you know, you got to keep people in prison. You got to lock them up. You can't arrest your way out of the drug epidemic we have. Which, remember, doesn't just affect us. There are 40,000 people have been murdered in Mexico in the last 4 years to maintain the industry that we buy our drugs from.
But imagine what? Go ahead.
Imagine if somebody was, you know, we need corn, and the only place we can get corn is from Mexico. And in the process of growing that corn, they have to murder 40,000 people a year to keep the corn flowing.
That's a good analogy. I mean, actually, it's a awful but accurate analogy. But we have a crime rate that's fairly unusual in highly industrialized, wealthy countries. And it has to do, I don't think one has to be a sociologist to understand the more poor people you have, the more crime you're going to have. Is it as simple as that?
No, it's not, actually. There are many poorer countries than us.
There they go. They're going after somebody right now. I hear that.
No, it might be an ambulance.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay.
It's not true. Poverty certainly is one of the things that provokes, especially crime of theft. You know, people, you know, you get, you know, Jean Valjean in Miserable, right?
Sure.
You got to feed your kids and do whatever it takes. But it's a very common association to think that the protection against crime is what explains the high prison rate. But actually, it isn't. It's the fact that once you get infected, as it were, with criminal justice involvement, you get a record, you get a fingerprint. You fall under the pale of a system that never lets you go and frequently takes you back in, you know, the revolving door of the prison. You come out, and within 3 years, about half to two-thirds of all people out of prison go back in again. often the new offense is related to the thing that put them there in the first place, their drug addiction or their drug dealing, which they go together. One of the ways you get drugs is by selling drugs and keeping some for yourself. And this drug problem, it revolves around that. It is a chronic, recurrent condition. That's how the medical diagnostic, catalogs talk about it. And everyone, you know, it's considered a disease. And yet, it's a disease you go to prison for.
So this is a revolving door. I mean, we've also heard that, but people just take it sort of, these are people that have criminal inclinations. They get, you know, they do their dirty deeds, and then they get caught, and then once they're out, they go back and do it again. So what we're talking about are, and I would think in the popular imagination, is flawed individuals, because there's enough poor people. I've lived in very poor neighborhoods, and 98% of the people there, have the same concerns as middle-class people.
And they're vulnerable, you know, and they're often the victims of crime, aren't they?
Oh, the 2%, they make life almost impossible.
The problem is that the things that affect crime, you mentioned poverty, crowding, lack of other opportunities, the things that foster crime are well known historically. They fluctuate all over the place from time to time, from country to country, and crime rates go up in regard to all kinds of complicated reasons. So, for example, there's been a big drop in crime in the United States in the last, since 93, very precipitously starting in 93. Which happens to be the peak of imprisonment. It's reaching its peak in the 90s. It's over 2 million people in prison now. What happened is that that one of the things that account this crime drop is the subject of at least a dozen books, and people say, oh, it's because we put all these bad guys away. That's why the crime dropped. It works. We should do it even more because crime is beginning to come up, especially violent crime. It's beginning to creep up again in a number of cities. But it turns out that there are several different complicated reasons why crime dropped. One of the most interesting ones, these economists in Chicago, what are they called, the Freakonomics, those guys?
Oh, yeah, right.
Dubner and Levitt. So they pointed out, and it's absolutely true, that one of the things that accounts for the crime drop is that most crimes are certainly most first offenses that get people in jail, arrested in jail, happen among young minority males. 16 to 26, let's say. Those are the years where you get initiated into criminal conduct as part of peer group, as part of a gang, neighborhood you're in. But that's who's doing the crimes. Way disproportionate to the number of such people, the crimes are being committed by the early ones. And then, as I said, once you're initiated, you're very likely to stay in the system. Well, it turns out that the regulations, the rules and laws in the United States affecting access to abortion and birth control, which came in the 70s, had their impact 20 years later, because let's say 20 years old is the average age of highest risk for first arrest and imprisonment. And 20 years after 1973, which is the beginning of the drug wars, is also the year that abortion became available and contraception became more widely available. And 20 years later, when the people of that generation turned 20, they were 25% less of them. The population, especially in single-parent families, poor families, very high-risk group, that population was 25% less in 93 than it was in 73. And lo and behold, there's this big crime drop in that period. The economy was important also, the availability of jobs for poor people. Those were the Clinton years in which a lot of jobs programs, and the economy was doing well. The unemployment rate dropped dramatically in let's say high school dropouts could get jobs. Actually, it's the expansion of McDonald's and those that world of employment, and a few other factors. And certainly, putting 2 million people in prison means there are 2 million people who aren't going to commit crimes who have committed. But most of those crimes were nonviolent drug offenses to start with, and they didn't stop. So if you look into it, there are a lot of good reasons for why crime goes up and down, but the reasons why prison goes up or down is quite different. That's a matter of public policy. We make the decision we're going to build more prisons and put people in them. And you said before, the politics of that are if you're against that, you're soft on crime, you're soft on drugs, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be used to hurt you as a political actor, so no one talks about it.
Right. And we are here on the Peter Werbe Show. My guest is Ernest Drucker. He's written A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. And Ernest Drucker is a scholar in residence and senior research associate at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and also professor emeritus of family and social medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. So there's this intertwining of these disciplines here as we approach this. You, I'm sure, I know you have, and I know many of our listeners have heard the phrase prison industrial complex comes from, you know, originally military industrial complex. Is that
right.
there's a literally a culture and an economic intertwining that creates this as a permanent institution that's not going to ever solve its problem. It's a bureaucracy that just reproduces itself. Yeah, do you feel comfortable with that phrase?
Well, it's actually a phrase. It's the title of a book by my one of my gurus, a criminologist from Norway named Niels Christie, who actually is, in my mind, one of the most profound thinkers about this as a moral issue. He has a book that's available online for free, actually, called Limits to Pain, and he makes the very important point that what punishment is about, and incarceration is a very severe form of punishment. That what punishment is about is the administration of pain by the state to individuals.
Yeah.
And he raises the question is, when is enough enough? And I think most of us can relate to that and understand that in regard to children, because people punish their children for their deviance from the rules of the household. And we understand the difference between sending a kid to bed without ice cream, slapping him on the wrist and banging his head against the wall. We understand that very well, individuals. So why don't we understand the difference between putting 100 per 100,000, 0.1% of the population in prison, and putting 700 per 100,000? Well, partly because it's invisible. It's you know, the prisons are out of sight quite deliberately, like mental hospitals. Or in fact, the prisons took the place of mental hospitals as we closed down mental hospitals beginning in the 50s as the medications came in. We began to replace them with other institutions, prisons, which today have a very significant population of mentally ill people. People who used to, you know, they were damaged in some way psychologically. They couldn't negotiate life. They violated rules. They didn't understand them. It probably included a lot of people who are called autistic now. And those people used to go to these other institutions, and now they go into the prisons where they really do badly. They're in solitary confinement. They commit suicide at much higher rates than other prisons. And the programs that treat them with medications, they use the medications. If you look at the medical programs in most prisons, they're 75% psychiatric workers and using psychiatric meds. They don't do a very good job of it because the prison environment itself is making you crazier every day. The kind of restrictions that are imposed on you, this isolation. We have more people in isolation, solitary, in the United States. We have 50%, more than 50% of all the people in solitary in the world are in American prisons. Right. It turns out it's economical. You don't need as many guards if you can just lock them up in a room for 23 hours a day and then let them out into a courtyard by themselves for 1 hour. Clear violation of human rights agreements that the United States is signatory to, but actually a very, very serious problem for the mentally ill who cannot control themselves and can't take advantage of the medication. So you get this kind of synergy of so many different factors once you put millions of people in prison. Remember, if there are millions in prison, there are three or four or five times as many who have been in prison.
Sure, and families that are affected. But tell me a little about the idea of this prison industrial complex. That is to say that so many people and so many groups of people have a vested interest in maintaining it as it is, from construction workers to prison guards. That's one of the reasons that it's hard.
You said it. You said it. It's like every other industry. It agitates for its interests. It tries to hold on to its market share. It expands if possible because there are economies of scale. There's significant privatization in the American system. Half the states in the union do not have any privatization. They don't use private companies to run their prisons or do anything. Although, if you look at the whole industry, building the prisons, supplying food, medical care, those are private. Those are done through the private sector. But the actual running of the prisons and the setting of its goals and objectives is not done in half the states. But the other half of the states, often states with the highest prison rates, have 25% of their prisons under the control of for-profit companies. Now, prisons are underfunded, famously. Even though they're very expensive, let's say $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year for a year in prison, when you have one prison guard for every two or three prisoners, it's an expensive proposition. And there's not enough money. The food quality has deteriorated badly. The money for medical care has gone way down in the prison system because budgets are being cut everywhere. When you add in the privatization of prisons, there's the profit factor. A company called Corrections Corporation of America is on the stock exchange. Their stock has been doing very well, thank you, throughout this whole period.
Let me do this, though, because I'm looking at the clock. I can't remember an interview that's gone by this quickly. We only have about 4.5 minutes left. My guest is Ernest Drucker. He's written A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. We're looking at the situation. It is just awful. I mean, when we just came out, what was happening in Los Angeles County Jail, the horrible treatment, the torture that's...
cover of the book. The cover of the book is from Los Angeles.
Well, I was going to just ask you that. Here, it's hard almost to describe this one relatively small room, which I can't count these guys up, must be at least 100 in double-decker bunks just really close to one another. What do we do? Do we just say, okay, guys, go home?
The Supreme Court has done that in California because they've been in violation of crowding rules and medical care rules for so long. They've been under all sorts of court orders to scale down the system. They insisted that they remove 30,000 people. And what they've done is they've shifted them into the county jails instead of the state's prison system. The state prison system medical care has been in receivership for 3 years now. Because of the number of people who died from inadequate medical care. It's interesting, the health care talk, prisoners are among the only civilians, the military has prison health care, obviously, but the only civilians in America who have an entitlement to medical care are prisoners under the Eighth Amendment, where the ruling was in the 60s that to deprive them of medical care was cruel and unusual punishment. Huh. So now they only do it for people who aren't prisoners.
But listen, you live in Manhattan, you work in Manhattan, I live in Detroit, and we know there's a problem with predatory neighbors, and they wind up to actually be our neighbors, maybe not next door, but in our city. What do we do? I mean, we have these people, these antisocial, asocial people around. How do we, without creating this horrible situation, which American prisons are, what do we do? Which is a pretty tough, big question. I realize.
Well, it's a tough question, but a big question, but it's actually not that tough. You do the same thing that you would do for anyone you cared about who's in trouble. And here is not the individual again, but like the city of Detroit you mentioned is a city in trouble because it's lost its industrial economic base. Abandonment of buildings. I've seen enough films about it, including Michael Moore's. Michigan in general is suffering from this. In a country that had its priorities straight, instead of spending this money on the prisons and continuing to worsen the lot of those who aren't able to survive that situation, they become predatory. They're arrested. Nothing to lose after a while. The guns and the violence of the gangs in prisons transfer to the outside world very quickly. The connections you have in prison become the only peer group you have outside that you can be part of anymore. You keep feeding this system. You're throwing gasoline on the fire. Those funds need to be used for, all too well. It's housing, it's education, it's social services, it's medical care. These are fundamental human rights in most developed democracies, not ours. You know, with this fight that's going on with the Tea Party, I've just finished writing an op-ed piece called Tea Party Justice, where the kind of vengefulness that's abroad now about every problem, from immigration to to drug users, to the use of the death penalty. If you saw this debate with Perry the other night where Brian Williams asked him about the 234 executions that took place in his term of office, and the audience breaks out in rapturous applause before he can even answer. Huh. This is very chilling when you think about the kind of retributive, vengeful kind of attitude that's abroad.
And this has an, this, and excuse me for interrupting, but unfortunately we're completely out of time, and this vengeful, punitive approach has not worked, and maybe as the economy worsens, it'll get even worse with more overcrowding, more people going through the so-called justice system. This is a book you should read, A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. My guest has been Ernest Drucker. We never even got to talking about the website for the book, plagueofprisons.com. And on there, there's a lot of resources that you can go to besides just seeing the book. There'll also be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Ernest Drucker, thanks for being a guest on the show.
Well, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives with a family in your community or around the world.
Now's the time.
Now, more than ever, help build it.
Visit Habitat.org.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
Everything That Rocks.
Thinking, trying to free my mind. you.